Welcome. It's nice to have you here. I'm so glad you could come. This is going to be such an exciting day. I hope you enjoy it. I think you will.
This week in Radical History for the week starting February 23rd.
Little surprises around every corner, but nothing dangerous.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey, hey!
This week in Radical History on February 23rd in 1971, Lieutenant William Calley confesses he directed the mass execution of South Vietnamese civilians at My Lai and implicates his commanding officer, Captain Ernest Medina, who he says issued the orders to murder. Both are dandies of the right-wingers who support their illegal activities. By the way, the initial investigating officer of the My Lai massacre who started the cover-up was then First Lieutenant Colin Powell of the Bush administration fame. Also more news on February 23rd for 1981. The White Papers on El Salvador issued by the State Department defending U.S. intervention and secret intervention and support of right-wing militia takeover of the government. One of the many atrocities the U.S. supported was death squads. The most infamous of them was the assassination of Catholic Bishop Oscar Romero, who was shot during a mass, a month after publicly asking U.S. government to stop military aid to El Salvadorian government. Also at his funeral, the government military bombers and snipers massacred 42 mourners.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so.
More illegal American interest in 1989. Lieutenant Colonel Ollie North is on trial for illegally selling weapons to Iran so that unlimited funds would still be available for the CIA's illegal and undeclared war against Nicaragua. Today, federal prosecutor Walsh agrees to drop the conspiracy charges against North. Though eventually found guilty of the cover-up, President Bush Sr. would give Ollie a Christmas pardon. Merry Christmas, Ollie North. Thanks for violating the Constitution for us.
We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. The United States is a superpower with enormous and divergent interests that it is committed to protect. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York. Enjoy the rest of the weekend.
This week in Radical History for February 24th, 1899, more of the same in Nicaragua. U.S. Marines begin fighting in the blue fields and mine its harbor, all to protect American interests. Also on February 24th, 1912, labor activist Elizabeth Flynn heads the Bread and Roses Lawrence textile strike of 20,000 women. Later today, police would attack 150 children and their parents at the town railroad station to suppress the strike. Also on February 24th, 1968, Pete Seeger, blacklisted for years on network television, is finally allowed to sing his previously censored Waist Deep in the Big Muddy on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. The Smothers Brothers show itself would eventually get axed, despite its high ratings, as corporate sponsors threaten to cancel network contracts because of the controversial acts the Smothers Brothers allow on their show.
Well, I'm not going to play it anymore. I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
This Week in Radical History for February 25th, 1860. About 100 Wyatt Indian men, women, and children were massacred during the World Renewal Ceremony. The massacre was carried out by white immigrants who had just settled in the area since 1850 as part of the California Gold Rush. The massacre was particularly grisly because the men who paddled to the island used hatchets, axes, and clubs to murder the victims. They purposefully avoided using their guns so that local residents in nearby town would not hear the slaughter. A little bit of Wisconsin news on February 25, 1902. The mill manager of Whiting Paper Company in Plover, Wisconsin, discharges a shipping clerk who is trying to organize workers in the plant. His outraged co-workers held a protest rally and demanded the company reinstate the clerk. When nothing happened, 25 union men shut down the plant and walked out, followed by about 20 women employed in the finishing room. By April, strikes disrupted plants up and down the Wisconsin River Valley. The American Federation of Labor and the Wisconsin State Federation of Labor sent support, but companies stood firm and by the end of April defeated the strikers. Well, lately the Washington Post has been in the news, and also in 1908 on this date, the Washington Post proposes that all anarchists be put to death, whether culpable or not, of any crime or offense. Also on February 25, 1913, the Patterson Silk Strike begins, involving over 20,000 workers. It would last for 6 months. Also on February 25, 1918, newspaper report that government charged Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman for working as German spies in foreign countries. Those charges, of course, would be later dismissed. 1 year later, Go Ahead, a circular attributed to American anarchists, appears throughout New England. In it, American anarchists threaten to dynamite officials in retaliation for the ongoing deportation and repression of anarchists are enduring. When pushed, often people push back. In related news on this date in 1920, anarchists Roberto Alia and Andrea Saldito are taken into custody by the Department of Justice without warrant or being arrested. They are held and beaten for 8 weeks and not allowed to contact family, friends, or lawyers, in an effort to get them informed on fellow anarchists. Attorney General Palmer's raid of terror was going full stream against immigrant radicals. To Palmer and his zealous band of immigrant pursuers, they were on a mission to rid the country of Red Satans, or anarchists who seemed bent on dismantling America's free enterprise system. A couple more items for February 25, 1964. 172,000 students boycott Chicago schools to protest segregation. Also on that date in 1970, Isla Vista, California, Bank of America burns, and riots break out to protest the Chicago 7 guilty verdicts, which ends with a lot of Bank of America buildings in flames. Part of a nationwide upheaval against the verdicts came down on the 19th, with 500,000 people in the streets, and explosions in 3 office buildings in New York, as well as more attacks in California, Washington, Maryland, and Michigan. Also on that date in 1993 in India, 60,000 preemptively arrested to prevent a demonstration against the ruling government. Last on this date in 1994, Israel, Jewish settler opens fire, kills 29 Palestinians praying in the mosque in Hebron. Oddly, Israeli government does not rush in and declare martial law and bulldoze Jewish homes in response. Barak Goldman, an American Orthodox Israel doctor who murdered 29 Arabs with automatic weapons, was proclaimed by some Jews to be a Kadash, meaning holy. This Week in Radical History for February 26, 1932, the man in black, Johnny Cash, is born. Jamie Lee Jackson on this date, February 26, 1965, was a young, unarmed civil rights protester who was shot by an Alabama state trooper. Jackson's death was among the many abuses of African Americans had to endure, and the Selma and Montgomery marches would spring up around them as important events in the American civil rights movement. Also on this date, 1974, Henry Ford, an anti-Semite, Nazi sympathizer, was revealed in a Senate report that Ford made tons of money on both sides of Axis and Allies of the war. It's the American way, after all, free market economics, etc. His profits from the Nazis still circulate in U.S. government politics to this day. Yeah, let's bail them all out. Have you driven your Ford lately?
This is your Radio World reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 26, 1976, the dead body of Anna Mae Pitzel Aquash was found. Anna Mae was a prominent member of the American Indian Movement. It is generally believed that she was executed by other AIM members who were convinced that she was an informant for the FBI. One thing is certain, the murder of Anna Mae Aquash was a direct result of the tactics used by the FBI's counterintelligence program, which regularly used disinformation and lies to plant suspicions and divide the American Indian Movement. Using these tactics, the FBI wiped out many amazing revolutionaries through murder and imprisonment. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. We have a very full program for you this morning as we feature a former Israeli soldier, Aaron Efrati, who has seen the light and is now a fervent voice for Palestinian rights and a sharp critic of the Israeli-U.S. occupation of the Palestinian homeland. We run a bit long this morning, so let's get right to Aaron Efrati's presentation, recorded exclusively for This Week in Palestine.
I'm really, really excited to be here. And I'm really happy that you're here because it's important for me to be in Boston, in the Boston area specifically, because I don't know if you realize, but this is one of the most important sites of policing, of understanding policing, understanding oppression of different communities in this country, and in highlighting the relationship with Israel and the Israeli military specifically. And I'm excited to be here among activists. And among people that are active, it was great just listening, go around the room and hearing where you come from and what you represent. I love these intimate settings. I'm doing events and workshops with groups from the Arizona border and LA and California all the way to New York. On all sides, I spend most of my year and my life in Jerusalem, back home. I'm doing my research there and my work there, and I'm coming to publish here because of restrictions, censorship, and stuff like that there. And many times I'm going into rooms of 100 to 500 people in a classroom, in an auditorium, for a church. And I have to say that this is, and I'm not just saying it, the best setting for me. The ability to have a conversation, a real conversation, I even feel awkward standing up right now. I feel like we need to sit in a circle and just talk. The idea of just having a conversation with a small presentation, but actually hearing from one another, how can we be involved? What are the next steps that we can take? What is the background of this whole story, this deadly exchange, and the military industries that Steve just mentioned? To break it down a little bit and have a conversation about how all of us can be involved here and how we can change realities on the ground in Palestine, but back home in the U.S., is my favorite thing. And this is something that you can only do in this intimate settings of Bob Dylan songs and Kumbaya and having candles. So, my name is Aaron Efrati, and I'm the executive director of RAYA. RAYA is researching the American-Israeli Alliance. And we started RAYA about a year and a half ago after working, like Steve mentioned, in many different positions in this country as a researcher. And as a contributor to special committees by the UN and the ICC and others, we understood there's a lack of in-depth research in the movement for justice in Palestine, but also in the movement for racial and economic justice in this country. There's amazing activists that are doing amazing work like you for, you know, dozens of years, but there is a lack of understanding of research, definitely of research in Hebrew or in Arabic, on our subject, specifically research into the companies, into the money behind the scenes. And we, a bunch of us, just left all the stuff that we were doing at the time and decided to dedicate all of our time to create an organization that only supplied research to activist groups and organizations. Our first campaign, our first contract was Jewish Voice for Peace that contracted us to make the Deadly Exchange report that I will talk about a little bit and can tell you where you can find and download for free. It's a 50-page report that just explains and breaking down the past 16 years of police exchanges from the U.S. to Israel for both directions. And we worked on their campaign. The second campaign that we're working on right now, as well as the police, is a project for the BNC, the Boycott National Committee in Ramallah, that contacted us to do a project about the Israeli academia. This year, PACB is taking on the Israeli academia to try to explain to people that it's not only one department or a few departments that are working with Israel as an arm of state violence or with the Israeli military, but it's really the university structure as a whole, the academia in Israel as a whole, which act as an arm of state violence in Israel. And we can talk about it all a bit in the end. Before I start this, I just want to say a few more words about myself, and I'm not going to go too deep because I know that all of you are already understanding the reality on the ground. I don't need to convince you. A lot of times I'm going into universities or into activist meeting groups, and there's a sense of me trying to explain to people that I came from a very Zionist background and a very militaristic background, and how I did my transformation, and I'm trying to pick people with me. I'm not going to try to do it with you. I understand that we're all on the same page here, but I do want to tell you just a few words so you know who I am. I was born and raised in Jerusalem. I'm a seventh-generation Jerusalemite. My grandpa was born in the old city of Jerusalem. My grandma was born in Jerusalem. My grandparents from my father's side came from Iraq originally, but for generations were in Jerusalem. My parents from my mother's side, both Holocaust survivors from Hungary. I grew up with a mother who was an officer in the military, one brother who was an officer in the Israeli military, and a father who was an officer in the Israeli military, and then the head of investigation of the Jerusalem police, and then the head of investigation of the West Bank police. So I'm coming from a good family. And I was supposed to be next one in line. I was supposed to be the next officer of the family. I was excited about that. I find myself joining the Israeli military, going into boot camp to be an infantry soldier. I joined the Nachal Brigade. I went through 7 months of boot camp. In my time there, we trained every day to fight in a war, the war with Syria, with Lebanon, with Egypt. We trained daily for a war, but in the end of the 7 months, I find myself in the middle of Hebron, El Khalil, the biggest Palestinian city, in the middle of Palestine, counting then at the time around 180,000 Palestinians, and in the middle of the city, a Jewish settlement counting at the time around 750 to 800 Jewish settlers. Around them, 500 soldiers like myself. Around us, 300 policemen like my dad. And very quickly, I will understand that I'm not fighting any war and I'm not protecting my country. I'm enforcing an apartheid regime, and I'm doing it with American weapons, with American bullets, with American contracts, and with American supervision. That will be my introduction to this topic. We're talking about 15 years ago, my introduction to the idea of exchanges, security exchanges between American police and American military to the Israeli military comes when I'm still in Hebron and we see delegations of American police in uniform getting into Hebron in a delegation and coming to observe our work. To prepare for their coming, we would, through a curfew, we'll do a curfew in the city of Hebron. You all know what a curfew is, how a curfew looks like. Yeah. So we would go out in a city of, again, 180,000 Palestinians. We will go out and just close everything. All the shops are closed. Everybody needs to go home, sometimes for a few hours, sometimes for a few days, sometimes for a few weeks. In the past, we also had months of curfew at a time. Nobody can go in and out. And we would do this special curfew specifically for the demonstration that we're going to pull for the American law enforcement that came to see us. We knew it was a big deal. We didn't completely understood what's going on. The only thing we knew was that there's going to be a demonstration of force. Because usually when you're trying to enact a sudden curfew or trying to close shops to take possessions from people, to separate people, separate families into different locations, you use a lot of arrests and you use a lot of weapons, disturbance weapons. And what you immediately create, and it's something that we can also see in the Gaza border in different places, and we can go into it a little later in the discussion, is that Israel is trying, or the Israeli army is trying to create a scenario in which there is a resistance. There is no other choice except to resist, sometime by force or a little force compared to the force that the Israeli army used, from the Palestinian side. If it's stones throwing, if it's just having a protest, if it's trying to use any other kind of violence with weapons or without, and give us a good reason to start firing the place up. Mm. And when we do it, we use all the ammo that we have. Our knowledge in Hebron was that everything that we will finish, every ammunition that we have and we finish that day, will be replaced the day after. And we're talking about from tear gas canisters to rubber bullets, that, by the way, are of course not rubber bullets. Mm-hmm. They're still bullets with a little bit of rubber around them, all the way to actual bullets, real regular bullets, and shooting, the use of drones, armored vehicle, tanks, shells, and collective punishment. All of that was in effect, and it was especially in effect when police delegations and American delegations came. I have a story about how I left the military. I don't know if you wanna go into it or not, but I I'll go. So I at some point after a few months of doing these things in Hebron, it was very clear to me that what we're doing is terrible. I mean, it was very clear to me that I am in some kind of a distress. I grew up learning that there is a right thing and a wrong. There's history, and I want to be on the right side of history. My grandma is an Auschwitz survivor. It was important for me to know that I am with the good guys. I think that every kid grew up thinking he is with the good guys. For me, it was a shock to understand that I'm not. And I got quite distressed. I went back home during those weeks, during those periods in Hebron, and I wasn't myself. I didn't recognize myself in the mirror. My mother didn't recognize me. We had a very hard and difficult moment to realize that I cannot continue my life the way it is. And the only thing I thought about doing at that moment was to give a phone call to a friend that I knew from a few years before that. He was the only lefty friend that I had. He was the only guy from a lefty family that I had any contact with. And the only reason I have his phone number was because he was really good at basketball. So I kept it. And I gave him a call. And his family was this lefty family, and he told me, look, Ilan, if you really want to understand what you're doing, what the implication of what you're doing is on people, you should consider the next time you're leaving the base and coming back home, instead of going to Jerusalem, go to Tel Aviv, and come with Anarchists Against the Wall to a protest in the village of Bilin. And I said, no. Protest with anarchists against crazy anarchists, throwing stones, no way. I am out. And my friend basically told me, well, Ilan, what do you got to lose? And I said, you know what? I don't think that I have anything to lose at that moment. And the next Friday I left for home, I put my uniform in a civilian bag, I put civilian clothes on me, and I found myself in Tel Aviv on a bus with Anarchists Against the Wall, that, by the way, are like a bunch of academic nerds. I have no idea. Anarchists Against the Wall. And we will get into Berlin, and I will be terrified. I was just terrified. It was my first time in the middle of a Palestinian village alone, without my unit behind me, without my six packs of ammunition, my M16, my two hand grenades, my vest, my helmet, and I was just terrified. All I heard was Arabic around me, and the only words I knew to say in Arabic were basically strip down and give me your ID. So I couldn't say that. And there was a few speeches, and then protests just started walking into the direction of what was then was still a fence. Today is a 20-foot concrete wall. Or 8 feet. I don't know how to do the conversion. 3 feet or...
20 feet.
Okay. 20 feet, 8.
How many meters?
I think it's 8.
8 meters, 24 feet.
It's 26 yards.
So today it's a concrete wall, and then it was still a fence, and there was marching into the direction of the fence, and I'm just terrified. I see drumming, and I see speeches, and I see people walk, and I just waiting to get the hell out of this village. I'm so scared that someone from the village is going to hurt me. That's the only thing I'm thinking about. I'm afraid of the Palestinians around me. And then in the corner of my eye, I see a few young men that are rising up and start throwing stones. We're still a mile away from the fence. We were very far. But a few kids are starting to throw stones in the direction of the fence. And then immediately, 360 around us, they're popping up units of the IDF and start shooting at us directly. They're shooting tear gas canisters and rubber bullets into our bodies. And I'm just terrified, you know, because I shot at people before, but nobody has ever shot at me back. And I was so scared that the only thing I can think about doing, people are running around me. And the only thing I could do is just say, stop shooting, stop shooting. I'm an Israeli soldier. I'm an Israeli soldier. Stop shooting. And one of the anarchist guys looking at me like this. I'm an Israeli soldier too. You can stop shooting. A bunch of Palestinian kids are saying, it's okay, we got it under control, go home. But they didn't stop shooting. And I felt like I was just completely choked up. I don't know if you had the misfortune to have tear gas canisters around you in your life, but we trained with them in the boot camp, but it was nothing like that. That was a developed and enhanced tear gas canisters that we never experienced. And I just felt like I cannot breathe. I was on four in the middle of the village. People were running by me. I thought, this is it. This is how I'm going to die. Until a young Palestinian man that passed me and realized that I'm not dealing with this very well, came back just for me, picked me up, took me into his home in the village. And that was it for me. I mean, I know that I'm not going back to do the same things again. I left the military. Eventually, it still took me a few months. I worked with Breaking the Silence and with Doctors Without Borders from inside the military. I gave medicine and permits to go through checkpoints into hospitals in Hebron, in South Mount Hebron. As a soldier, I left the military and I started doing research immediately. For me, it was obvious that I want to understand why I was lied to. I want to understand who is profiting from this, who is making these tear gas canisters, who is making this weapon. And I went into a first phase of researching by just interviewing soldiers. I would go and interview soldiers through my role as in Breaking the Silence for 2.5 years. And at some point, I understood that I'm not getting anywhere because I'm interviewing people that are telling me important stories that needs to be shared with the world. But they all believed what I believed going in. Some of them believe it's for security. Some of them believe it's just racism. Some of them believe it's wrong. But none of them could talk about why are we actually there? Who is profiting from us being there? And going deeper into research, I worked for the Washington Post for a year, and going deeper and deeper into the research, there's two things I encountered. The first was money, and the second was the U.S. In every corner I turned, I got back to the U.S., and I got back to money and to private companies. It got into a certain point when I researched a tear gas canister in 2008 that was sold from Israel to the government of Singapore. That in the press release that was out in 2008, Israel basically said this tear gas canister is the most developed and most deadliest tear gas canister ever produced in the world. And I remember sitting and thinking, who the hell will produce something like that? And who the hell will be tested on? And this realization, of course, that I was working in a laboratory for years, forced as someone who's testing the weapons on human beings, and then later, in the last almost 15 years, as someone who joined the protesters and Palestinians as a lab rat, as someone who runs from these weapons. And my research became more and more specific. I hit a wall at some point with the Israeli censorship. In Israel, I started being interrogated in the end of 2000, after the Kessler operation. The end of 2008, the beginning of 2009, and the Washington Post gave me a visa to come to the U.S. and continue publishing stories. Here in the U.S., I would give research into journalists, and they would publish it later on in The Guardian. And then I had the opportunity to go back and remember my time as a soldier when American law enforcement used to come. And remember that this is something that I really want to research. And I think this will be a good kind of segue to go back. Where should I go? I'll stay here. To go back and try to understand what we're talking about. So the conversation continues. I just want to show you a few slides that maybe demonstrate. If you don't see, I can read some of it out loud.
Do you
have
to sit here?
No, I think it's... Is that okay? Mr. Sunday? Mm-hmm. Can you see?
Yes.
Nobody can sit here.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect. So you can hit it. Let's start. So this is obviously the Gaza border. I could just as easily put the U.S.-Mexico border here in the slideshow, right? There's 100 snipers that are on the border at every given time since March, and they're waiting for protesters from Gaza to come close to the border from different angles to shoot them up. And I think this image is quite famous. A lot of people understand what's happening. A lot of people, of course, you know that there's more than 200 Gazans that got killed in the last 6 months. It's much more. It's since March.
Yeah.
So almost a year now of protesting. But we don't hear enough, even in our circles in the left, what kind of weapons are being in use on these borders. And the truth is that most weapons that is being shot at the border right now are weapons that are being manufactured in cities across the U.S. And that in some way, your money, your tax money, is paying for them. And we're going to get that. So you can hit it again. And this is just a picture from the village, from Belin, from my time there, of the tear gas. You can move on as well. So Steve touched it in the beginning, and I kind of want to elaborate. When my research started to go into the collaboration between police, the American local police, and the Israel military 10 years ago, I never dreamed that we get to where we are today. And maybe I did it yesterday in Cambridge, maybe I should start with the end instead of the beginning. The end is that yesterday we had an exciting event in Cambridge. We had an event, we had a full room with activists from different groups and different areas and individual activists that came together to a very energized conversation about why Boston is so important and what we can do here. So this conversation is following a great group that already is working here on the ground about what's happening. The other thing that Steve touched is that there's a delegation of the ADL. The ADL is sponsoring a free trip for policemen across this region to go to 10 days, fully paid, to Israel and train the Israeli military on occupied ground, on occupied people, and to see for themselves some of the weapons that's being used on the ground. They're leaving this Sunday. I'm leaving on Monday to follow the delegation and to track them there for the next 10 days. Wow. So, like I did in yesterday in Cambridge, I will start by saying this conversation is not theoretical. It's very active, and we can see results of what's happening in the next few months. But already now, a part of this conversation, I hope, will be how we can strategize around this specific delegation and for the long run. And if you have any questions or stuff that you will want to know while I'm there in real time with the delegation, we can talk about it and we can be a part. I'm going to be in Palestine for the next 2 months, starting with this delegation. So what is this delegation? Where does it come from? Very shortly, a few months after 9/11, the collaboration and the connections between Israel and the U.S. obviously were forged dozens of years ago. It doesn't start from now. Israel and the U.S. worked in Latin America and in Africa during the 60s and the 70s. They made sure that they're selling weapons to the same side of regimes at the same time in a post-colonial time. So the collaboration was always there. But the U.S. was always the big player, and Israel was kind of getting the leftovers, in a way, in this world of what we call privatized security. Post-9/11 moment is happening, in which Israel is being held as the model of security. In the post-9/11 era, people are looking for answers, and Israel claimed that they have it. That was a very easy gateway to the government to approve starting sending delegations of police, local police, into Israel to train with the Israel military and Israeli police. The first delegation that goes months after 9/11, really, just after 9/11, including NYPD, LYPD, but also agents that are going to build ICE less than a year after that. So from Border Police. And also workers of the MTA. MTA from New York. So transportation police is going with them. In the delegations after that, we will see a few other interesting actors. In the 16 years post 9/11, what we see is more than 40 states that sends more than 300 departments, agents, and offices to these delegations. So we're talking about across the United States. It's not in one location. We can identify a place. It's in big cities like Boston and in tiny cities and tiny communities that are sending their police officers to train within Israel military on military weapons and with military weapons that are coming back to the U.S. You can hit it again. But like I said, there's other agencies that are going from day one, including CIA and FBI and MTA, but also campus security that is going with this delegation. So think about it. A university police or university security company will meet with FBI and CIA and local police and state police, all of them together in a place like Belin, to get a presentation about how you disrupt a protest. And then they come back here. And what they saw there is, how do Israel deal with our enemy, with the Palestinian, with terrorists? But when they come back here, they're just in your city and in your neighborhoods. And you, my friends, who are organizing protests and organizing events, become the enemy. So this is something that really affects all of us, and it's very scary. This is just a partial list of everyone that's going. Border police, ICE, for me, and university police are really highlighting how scary this situation is and who's really being impacted by it. Thank you. So the types of training they see, it will all go under anti-terrorism. And when you start organizing around this subject, all you will hear that this is just an anti-terror joint collaboration. One group going to the other to learn about the dangers of homegrown terrorism and outside terrorism in the post-9/11 moment. The truth is that what we learned from researching in depth for years, this delegation, is that under the banner of anti-terrorism, what they're really learning is a few things. The first is crowd control and riot disposals, the way they call it. Surveillance, deep surveillance of entire populations and the entire home, by using mostly racial profiling. You know, because in Israel, the use of racial profiling is so basic, is so ingrained into society, that the state itself, Israel itself as a state, is built on the idea of racial profiling. I mean, the idea of separating the Israeli Jews and Palestinians is based on the idea that we can identify them, who is who. Now, I said it yesterday in Cambridge, I'm going to say it again, do you know how we say racial profiling in Hebrew? You don't. Because we don't. There is no term for racial profiling in Hebrew. Okay? It's so basic for us in the language that we didn't thought that we need to use it. When academics or activists are saying racial profiling, they're saying it in English. Racial profiling. Because it's so basic to us. The sponsors of these delegations, very important. Before I run on the sponsor, I will say we believe that these sponsors that we can target in local BDS campaigns can be very effective to understand what their motives are and to stop these delegations. But what we really believe in RIA, in researching the American-Israeli Alliance, that this is all what we call cover. Okay, a cover for something much deeper. A cover to what we see as the American-Israeli military-industrial complex. But let's run who's really paying for it. So we have two type of groups that are paying for this trip. The first is Jewish groups. Jewish groups, that their politics, their identity as Zionist groups, see themselves as wanting to help the connection, the collaboration between the U.S. and Israel, and they're doing it through police and military training. So you have AIPAC, that's not very surprising, and you have ADL, that shouldn't surprise you as well. But the ADL are a self-proclaimed civil rights organization. And a civil rights organization that is sending police officers to what they call themselves a war zone to train with the Israeli military. The ADL is probably, we can go down the list, but the ADL is probably the most important organization that you need to know about this region, because they are the main organization in this region that's sending the police departments to train in Israel. But we have others as well. And we can pull up these slides afterwards if you want the discussion, kind of share the names with all of you so you have it. So the funding goes through a few channels. Obviously, an organization like the ADL is a 501c3, so it's tax, you know, process in this country. But you have private corporations that are involved, and you have federal grants. And this is where it becomes interesting. You have federal grants like the Department of Justice or the Department of Defense that are sending money, but it's not on the books of these delegations. So what we saw through our research is that you have a grant for the Department of Justice, for example, that will send money into, for example, the ADL for different reasons. And then the ADL will funnel some of this money into these delegations, will pay for everything. You basically get a free tour, a free trip if you're a police officer, including the flight, the stay, the food, and everything in between. And the money is just appearing in the ADL bank account. Right, so it's private donations, but it's also the federal state that is sending the money. The one other thing that we're researching in RIA, according to the idea of this is much deeper than just this delegation, or what this delegation is really hiding behind them, is the 1033 program. Have you ever heard about the 1033 program? So the 1033 program is a program that started in the 90s under President Clinton in the U.S. as a way to fight in the war, the war on drugs. And basically what it says is that local U.S. Police departments can receive surplus military gear being funneled from the military after being used in Iraq, for example, in the Gulf War, into their departments and used. Now, in the post-9/11 moment, what happened is that the program, the 1033 program, expanded dramatically. And the weapons started being used by local police members expanded dramatically. Now, we're not only talking about certain weapons that are scary enough, we're talking about drones, we're talking about tanks, grenade launchers, that are all in the hands of local police departments. And what we did in RISE is start tracking all the police departments that we can with understanding of what kind of military weapons or technology they are hosting. Now, some of these weapons, some of these military tactics and weapons can be acquired by them after they went on the delegation, saw something they liked, and they can order it through the program, through the 1033 program. Now, there's a caveat in the program. After you get this new toy, your tank, your drone, your grenade launcher, you have to use it in the first year of getting it. If you are not using it, it can be taken back and be redistributed. So police officers and police departments have an incentive to use military weapons on American streets so they can keep them and continue playing with them. You know what? Just before we talk, very quickly, we're talking about planes and helicopters, armored vehicle, full body gear, grenade launchers, like we said, assault rifle. I mean, all of this stuff are insane enough when we're talking about American colonialism around the world. But again, this is all weapons that are in the middle of Detroit, Philadelphia, Boston. The Boston Police Department have military weapons, and it is in use for certain communities. So what are they actually learning there? You know, we can sit here in the room and claim, and we will be right, that U.S. Local police departments do not need Israel to act as an arm of state violence, that they were targeting certain communities of colors and other communities, Muslims in this country, for years. They didn't need this training. But they are going and they are learning specific things, what Israel is calling battle-proven tactics and weapons. They learn how to control a population altogether while still claiming they are a democracy, while still claiming this is for security. There's something unique in these delegations because it's not delegation to places like Russia or Syria or China where the governments just don't care about the appearance, where the government just claim that they are dictatorships and they don't care. Israel is playing this delicate balance with the world of we're still a democracy that defends ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. love the sounds of that. Mm-hmm. So there are stuff that is being learned. What we learned specifically that is being exchanged is A, expanded surveillance. So deep surveillance, the Israeli corporation and the Israeli private companies of surveillance are the leading companies in the world. And we're talking about all the way from video cameras and drones, where Israel surpassed the United States in 2012, and now the leading sales country or sales industry in the drone efficacy, all the way to private companies that supply local police department here the ability to tap every one of our phones at will. And it's in use in this area. The second is racial profiling. Again, how do you do an effective racial profiling across the country, and it's in use very close to here, and we'll talk about it in a second. And the last one is suppressing of public protests and use of force. What Israel does, and if we really want to strip it down, a lot of people can talk about the brilliance of the Israeli model, the golden model of security. What Israel really does is that they have one of the strongest military in the world against civilians. That's the bottom line. When you get to a protest in a village and all you have is kids with stones in their hands and you have tanks and airplanes and machinery, you will always win. It's not that difficult. The question is, are you willing to go this extra mile and just shoot at kids and women and men and Sukkot. So, just to explain the things very quickly with a few concrete examples to each one. When we were talking about Sivens, did you all heard about the demographic units? So the NYPD post 9/11 is studying a new unit called the demographics unit. You can also know them as under the name Musclobos. They will go, it's Middle Eastern men from NYPD that will go disguised to Muslims into masks across the cities, and the region in New York, and will start collecting intel about the people that are coming to praying. But not only that, if they will suspect anyone of doing more than just being a part of the community, talking about what they claim is terrorism or any resistance to the current government, they will disappear from New York. We're talking between 2002 and 12 into black sites in Chicago and New York, where they will be interrogated without the presence of a lawyer or their family knowing. We're talking about completely the Palestinian model on U.S. citizens. The demographic unit was exposed in 2012, and they, in the hearings that were at the time in 2012 out in public, they admitted that they modeled the demographic units on a unit in the Israeli military called Mistalavim. Mistalavim in Hebrew means to be Arab or to become an Arab. Mistalavims are a bunch of soldiers, a unit in the Israeli military, of people looking like me, Arab Jews, that will go into Palestinian communities and will embed themselves in the community and will start riots or will start problems like the young man that I told you threw stones in the beginning of the protest. Sometimes they will start some kind of riot, so the Israeli army will have a reason to fire the place up. Sometimes they will just make arrest from inside the community in the middle of the night or track people. So there are police units that are already modeled on these tactics. The second is racial profiling. Racial profiling, the easiest model to talk about is the airport model. Almost every airport in the United States right now is using Israeli technology and Israeli tactics. But do you know which airport was the first one to use the Israeli model?
Boston.
The Logan Airport. The Logan Airport was the first one that hired officially the man that was in charge of the Israeli airport security systems in the entire country. They brought it into Logan Airports in 2007, and since then, it spread across the United States. Almost every airport is using special cameras and special techniques of the Israeli technology. And the last one is the use of force. Now, in the use of force, we can talk about countless weapons and countless technologies that are being used on the ground in the U.S. right now in the past 15 years or so, but I want to focus on one specific. And that is the Tavor. The Tavor gun is an automatic rifle that basically was supposed to replace the M16. So Israel used the M16, the Israeli military used the M16 for years, and at some point the Israeli industry decided that they want to replace it with an Israeli-manufactured automatic weapon to start having their soldier use in Palestinian cities, in East Jerusalem, and in different places. We called it the Tavor, and we are using it right now since last March on the Gaza border. So most of the sniper weapons that we see on the Gaza border are the Tavor. But except for us using it, the Tavor right now, the Israeli automatic rifle, is used in PDs across the country. There's 15,000 holds across the U.S., including citizens, that can buy it directly from the company that manufactured it in Israel, but sells it in the U.S. And PDs, again, we're going back to the point that we talked about earlier, can order it after they've seen it in use and can receive it under the 1033 program, the surplus weapons program. So this is right now in Gaza, one of the new things that we saw and we didn't saw before. And I said in the beginning, we have to look at what happened on the Gaza border as a site for testing of new technology. Is a drone that is not only surveilled what's happening underneath him, but dropping tear gas canisters on protesters from the air by a push of a button. From afar, this is something that we predict in Raya that we will see in American streets or, of course, on the U.S.-Mexico border very soon. An Israeli technology that is already being viewed by these delegations. These delegations, except for going into Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and different places, will go into Bilin on a Friday to see a protest, will go to the Gaza border So local police departments of the U.S. will go to the Gaza border and sit on the Gaza border and will see how the Israeli army is treating the border and border security. They will go to military prisons across the country. They will meet with Palestinian political prisoners. They will understand how they work. They will go into Bethlehem and they will meet Palestinian local police, and they will learn how Israel is activating the local police, the Palestinian local police, to work for them. That's one of the things that's really interesting them. They will meet with media people and learn how the Israeli army can show the narrative that is coming out from every department. Again, something that's really interesting them. And they will go into private Israeli weapon companies and talk with them about the possibility of using some of this technology. Thank you, Noble. So, you know, this is, we talked about the 1033 program and the need to use some of this technology and some of these weapons in the first year. This is a picture you all know from Ferguson 2014, of course. The use of armored vehicles wasn't there only because we have militarized police and these delegations are enforcing and enhancing this militarized police, but also because they really have to use this technology and weapons. They have to use tanks going into civilian streets and inner cities in this country if they want to keep their toys. So again, I thought it was incredible. Okay, so I'm going to wrap it up because I really want to have a conversation. I will just say one last thing, and that might be the bottom line of all of this and why we have to care and why we have to be a part of it, because we are all already a part of the problem. And I want to go out with talking a little bit about the Israeli-American military-industrial complex. I touched on it before, but I want to kind of explain what I mean. So you all know about the military aid package, right? You know that the U.S. has given Israel military aid since 2007 until 2018. There was one deal for 10 years that basically means that your tax money is going in the form of $30 billion over the course of 10 years, $3 billion every year to Israel in military aid. Now, it increased through the years. It was 3.1 and 3.2, but $3 billion every year, and there was a lot of support for it, obviously, in the government. And there was some opposition, some good opposition, some campaigns to end the $30 billion to Israel. But even the opposition usually talked about how the United States has given presents to the Israeli army, how you, with your tax money, are just giving presents to the Israeli military. They didn't talk about how these deals were actually structured. So in the last 10 years, the deals were structured in a way that 74% of the military aid was had to be bought in American contracts from private companies in the U.S. of weapons to be used in Palestine. And 26%, a little less than 26%, could have been used by the Israeli own industries, military industries in Israel to develop and sell their own weapons. It was a deal that no other country in the world received from the U.S. except for Israel. Israel had the ability to become one of the most important, influential, and largest weapon companies as a country, as a state, in the world. So much so that in 2012, something dramatic happened. India is the biggest buyer of weapons in the world, and the U.S. was their main supplier for years. In 2012, a second before another contract was signed for the next 25 years between the United States and India, for the buy of drones, the buy of drones and technology, Israel basically bumped the U.S. and won over a contract. That's something that's resident with the government for many years. And in 2016, something interesting happened. President Obama, as a parting gift, in September 2016, just before he left office, decided to sign a new military aid package with Netanyahu. Now, the years before that, there was a lot of conversation about the tense relationship between Netanyahu and Obama, and nobody completely understood how his government, from all governments, decided to up the new military aid package for the next 10 years that is in effect right now to $38 billion. $3.8 billion every year to the Israeli military. And again, there was a lot of support, and a few people in our circles in the Movement for Justice in Palestine and Economic Justice here in the U.S. that say, why are we doing this unprecedented amount of money into a military that is very rich, very successful, and oppressing millions of human beings without any basic rights? But what people did not talk about enough was the caveat and the fine print of this new contract. So when the contract was signed, it was up to $38 billion. But what we didn't talk about was that the amount, the percentage that have to be bought from America in contracts went up to 100%. So 100% of the military aid is now being bought from private companies in the U.S. We all need to understand those deals, and we all need to understand the military aid package as a way for U.S. Military industries to profit, to make a killing, literally, on the backs of Palestinians. It's money that is being funneled into private companies that send their technology and weapons to be tested on human beings on the other side of the world before coming back here, being sold around the world as battle-proven, and being used here in the U.S. This is in many, many ways a local issue, not a foreign policy one, but a domestic one that you have the power to influence. And this is our website, PalestineIsHere.org. Palestine is Here is a database that RIA created, researching the American-Israeli Alliance, our organization, created for activists across the country. If you go to PalestineIsHere.org, you can do two things. The first is you can put your zip code or your address in it, and you can learn which police officer, police department, TSA, ICE agent trained from your area in Israel in the last 16 years. We still have thousands of names that are being uploaded every week into the database because part of our process is to prove all of this data. And there's a lot of data that we achieve, and we want to make sure that we get it right. So if you don't see your local police department there, wait a week or two, they're probably going to be there. The second thing that you can do, except for track that and understand who's already working on the ground to oppose this delegation, is to go into the reports tab on the website and download for free a report about the End of Deadly Exchange that we wrote for Jewish Voice for Peace about their very successful campaign, and to read about this background, to understand this background. Now, the last week was full of surprises because I told you that on Sunday, the delegation of the ADL is traveling to Israel, and I told you that on Monday I'm going to track them. What I didn't tell you, and maybe some of you heard today, is that behind the scenes we were working for the past few weeks after realizing who the police officers that are traveling to start and create local groups in their towns, putting pressure on their city council, their police departments, to stop this delegation from happening, to stop their agents, their policemen, from traveling to Israel. And in unprecedented moment, we got two huge wins last week. The Vermont State Police officer that was supposed to be on the trip and got some pressure from his community decided to cancel and pull out in the last minute. Mm-hmm. And the second police officer was from?
Northampton.
Northampton, Massachusetts. Now, we really believe...
Chief of Police.
The chief of police. Yeah. We really believe that there is a Boston Police Department officer sitting on this delegation. And already today, after our meeting yesterday in Cambridge, there was a letter coming out to the mayor, asking him to immediately look into it and try to explain to us, like to explain to all of you, as activists in this city, how can a police officer that is in charge of your security in this city go and train with a military force on military ground, on occupied people. So there's already a campaign full thing going on, and this is the time to jump on it. The one really last thing that I want to share with you, just before we go jump into a conversation, is just something remarkable that happened. And I shared it yesterday in Cambridge, and I thought it was strong. In 2016, there was something interesting that was going on. I'm interviewing a lot of police officers and military officers that are traveling to Israel and training from both sides. In 2016, something happened that never happened before. I interviewed a few officers, Air Force officers from the U.S. military that traveled to Israel to train for over a month with another 1,000 officers from the U.S., including police and CIA and military, on the ground with the Israeli Air Force. It was something that never happened before. It was the largest number of U.S. Air Force or military personnel ever together in a training outside of the U.S. And when they came back, I just asked them, what did they saw there? And why was it important? Because I truly, with all my experience, couldn't understand. And all of them, all the people that I interviewed, said the same exact thing. They said, we have no idea All we talked about for over a month was short-range missiles, Lebanon, Syria, all kind of threats that we just do not have in the U.S. We have no way to implement any of the things we talked about here. But all of them also said another thing. Throughout the month, all the time, people in suits came in and out of the rooms, and we got presentations from private companies on private missiles and defense mechanism that were in the room. I still couldn't completely understand what they were doing there, and about 3 months after that, we got an answer. Lockheed Martin published that their new airplane, F-35, that's supposed to replace the F-16 airplane, in billions of dollars, is being sold to Israel exclusively under the new military aid package that is going to come about. And Israel just bought in one night more than 100 airplanes that Israeli officials, Israeli Air Force pilots, said they do not want to use. Another unprecedented thing. The Israeli army coming out against government, the U.S. government, the Israeli government, that are creating a deal with a local private company. The Israel pilots are saying, we know about the F-35 for years. It's a bust. Yeah. American pilots do not want to use it. They're saying it's dangerous for the pilots themselves. Forget about the people being affected or targeted by this war airplanes. They say we don't need this, and we're afraid to use it. We refuse to receive those airplanes. We should go back on the deal. But of course, they couldn't, because if we're getting money to buy these airplanes, then we have to follow through. So Israel is buying more than 100. We already have around 50. There's another around 70. They're on the way of F-35. But there is a discussion coming out in Israel, something unprecedented. There's a war between the military, like I said, and the government. And we, the citizens, are being exposed to it for the first time, to this tension. And then something truly amazing happened that didn't happen to me in my years of researching or my years as a human being or as an Israeli. Lockheed Martin, a private weapon company located in the U.S., is buying a full ad page in Haaretz newspaper. Haaretz, like the left, it's supposed to be the lefty newspaper in Israel, the liberal left newspaper in Israel, buying a full page ad and publicizing a message directed to Israelis in Hebrew. They're saying, congratulations, Israel, the F-35, the great one, the Adil in Hebrew, the great one, is coming home soon. A private weapon company talking to civilians on the other side of the world to quiet the conversation so it won't hurt their deal. We're all playing in a much bigger game that we want to admit. But it starts by putting pressure locally and BDS campaigns locally and understanding that the money that is coming out from here and going back to private hands and to private pockets in the U.S. is affecting millions of lives in Palestine and in the U.S. So let's talk about what we can do about it. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Blairites cry for their lost heaven. One detects a tenuous trope. Now there are seven. Seven little Blairites up to naughty tricks. One leaves because of Brexit. Now there are six. Six little Blairites sharpening their knives. One says something racist. Now there are five. Five little Blairites waiting by the door. One calls lefties anti-Semites. Now there are four. Four little Blairites yearning to be free. One gets sick of pacifism. Now there are three. Three little Blairites wondering what to do. One takes cash from a centrist think tank. Now there are two. Two little Blairites not having any fun. One writes a piece for the Murdoch press. Now there is one. one little Blairite facing deselection, so they form a party with their chums to stand in the next election. Eight little Blairites, happy as can be. Will others join their jolly crew? We'll have to wait and see. Well, well, three little Tories, desperate to remain, spy their little Blairite chums and join their gravy train.
Back to BCFM's Politics Show with retired international relations lecturer and author Ron Mandel and me, Tony Gosling. The US trade war, they're losing it. It's hitting US high-tech manufacturers and farmers alike. So what's the point, Donald, in starting a war? You can't win. Like Vietnam or Syria. It's that great John Stockwell book, In Search of Enemies. Also, David Icke had his Australian visa refused and had to cancel a sellout tour. In the US, Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro is just one of many who have very different ideas about what we hear in the mass media and what the Jewish identity really means. Compared to what the Israeli state and the Zionists are telling us. And his audience fills a US stadium. Before all that, she's very patiently been waiting. Here is Christine Townsend. Christine's a former teacher and education campaigner. Hi, Christine, and thanks for being so patient.
Are you welcome, Tony?
Can you just bring us up to speed on some of the issues with schools, education in the city? I know you particularly wanted to talk about Steiner Academies. Now, what is a Steiner Academy?
Well, Steiner is a form of education, a kind of different philosophy. And there are now four state-funded free schools in Britain, and one happens to be in Bristol.
OK, do you know anything about Rudolf Steiner originally?
Well, I've heard the rumours about his philosophy and his approach.
Well, he was originally in the Nazi Party, joined the Nazi Party in the early 1930s, late 1920s, but then he left. He said, well, as a lot of people do, I suppose, they see someone, he's calling himself a socialist, seems to be okay, but then everything sort of turned around. But anyway, so Steiner himself and this academy, any idea about the way children are taught differently in these places?
Well, my understanding, because I have been into the Bristol Steiner Academy numerous times for different reasons, there's a lot more outdoor education. They do woodwork, which is something that might have been done decades ago, but working with wood is quite rare, probably, in the mainstream sort of sector. They're not quite as interested in getting children to do the academic side at a very young age. So they're a lot more in tuned with how the children themselves look to develop from their own, from within.
Can I just say, I think that's fantastic, because we seem to have a almost obsession, Ron, nowadays with getting children at very, very young ages to do. The idea is to sort of pitch at them things that children maybe even 2 or 3 years older might previously have been done. And the idea is, well, you know, this can bring them on faster.
Well, that puts a lot of pressure on children. Education has to be not just about intellectual development, it's about emotional and social development. And anything that puts pressure on, unnecessary pressure on children could hamper their development altogether.
So what's happening with the Steiner Academy, Christine?
Well, the Ofsted were in there last November, and it has since transpired that there's clearly been some kind of national direction from the Department of Education towards Ofsted, because there was a sweep of inspections across these Steiner state-funded free schools. And it has come out the other end that Ofsted have said that three of them, including the one in Fish Ponds in Bristol, are inadequate. And the governing body are in the process of trying to raise money. The parents, there's a large percentage, from the sounds of things, of the parents that are very supportive of what the governors are trying to do, because they want to challenge this Ofsted inspection. So that was reported, and then probably about 10 days ago, the Regional Schools Commissioner has since written to the governing body of the Steiner in Bristol and said that they have to join a multi-academy trust. They have a week to do this, or they risk having penalties within their funding agreements. So the pressure is kind of coming onto the Steiner Academy in Fish Ponds to join a multi-academy trust. That isn't going to be a multi-academy trust that involves the other Steiner schools. And I think that's probably the thing that the parents and the governing bodies are very upset about, because they understand the way in which multi-academies trust means that probably, certainly over time, I would have thought that the philosophy and the different approaches that the Steiner schools use will become obsolete, and they will be crushed by the approaches of the multi-academy trust which they have joined.
Is that a good thing?
Well, the point of the Steiner Academy was to have a different approach to education, particularly at a young age. And the parents and the people that got involved with the project got involved because that was what the promise was. If you change that, then you change the nature of the approach to the education, and you change the nature of the philosophies that are coming through and the way in which the children are being taught. And you will appeal to a different group of parents. So it will become another school that is run by a multi-academy trust.
Okay. Is there any real advantage of having a multi-academy trust? Is small beautiful, or is big beautiful?
My understanding is that these four schools are standalone academies, and if they had at some point historically come together to form a multi-academy trust, they may well be in a stronger position now to resist what it is that the Regional Schools Commissioner is trying to do. But the Steiner Academy is only a one-form entry. It's an all-through school, but it's a one-form entry. It's quite a small institution, and it's on its own pretty much, because it's a standalone as an academy. And it's quite easy pickings, really, particularly because Ofsted have now said you're inadequate, and it's quite difficult to fight an inadequate ruling from Ofsted.
So if they made it clear and public what is inadequate?
There were some pretty serious safeguarding concerns, yeah. The Ofsted report that's actually in the public domain talks about children being unnecessarily restrained. They're talking about safeguarding issues not being shared at the multi-agency level. These are serious safeguarding concerns. They're talking about the other big thing that the RSC will be looking at is the inadequate judgment that Ofsted have given to the management and the leadership within the school. Because what that means is that Ofsted don't judge the management and the leadership, meaning the governing body, to be in it, to have the capacity or the ability to make improvements.
I mean, do you think Ofsted are flexible enough? I mean, the whole idea of introducing all these educational reforms has been that we want more diversity in our schools. But of course, that means that there's a whole tick box exercise that might not necessarily be appropriate for a school which is otherwise quite good.
That isn't an argument for safeguarding, Tony, no matter what. I mean, you know, safeguarding is safeguarding, and that's about making sure that children are protected and that systems are followed. And you will only protect children if the institution is following the systems that exist in order to protect children. So that's the first thing I'll say about safeguarding. I think probably the approach that the parents and the governing body have is that their approach is different, and therefore it doesn't fit the Ofsted tick box, as you refer to it, in terms of the inspection outcomes. I mean, the big thing will be when the children get to the point where they're doing their GCSEs. That's going to be the big test. It's just that it's not been open long enough for that cohort to run through and take those GCSEs at age 16. It's quite new. You know, it's quite a new institution. They're on at least their second head teacher that I'm aware of. So, you know, it's early days really for them. Maybe it's fallen out of political favour. That the free school programme was very much Michael Gove's kind of little baby that he was interested in. It was his area. And free schools that sit outside what the current regime, if you like, consider to be acceptable could well, you know, Steiner could well fit into that category.
There was the head of Ofsted was on Five Live this week. I think it was, oh gosh, maybe even yesterday morning, talking about safeguarding. And somebody phoned in to say that my 14-year-old was removed from a particular school because of sticking two fingers up. He was seen doing this, and that was seen to be a safeguarding concern. So one does wonder whether sometimes rules are being bent, and whether even internally in schools, whether these, you know, potential danger to children is being used as an excuse to remove pupils for other reasons.
Safeguarding as a word and as a term can be used, and I've seen it used locally as well, can be used as it's quite difficult to argue with things as safeguarding. If it's a safeguarding concern, it's quite difficult to challenge that. So if it's framed in such a way, I mean, a child sticking two fingers up, I wouldn't consider that to be a safeguarding issue. We don't know what else has gone on for that child, because you can only permanently exclude a child for, well, either a very, very serious incident, or it's persistent disruptive behaviour. And persistent means over quite a long period of time, and you would need to have the documented evidence of the steps that you've taken as a school in order to support that child, in order to get rid of them.
Well,
what
I say is you gave a lot better answer just then
than the Amanda Spielman.
Yes, did yesterday. Also, we were just talking, weren't we, with the councillors about Cottam School and this whole situation in Stoke Lodge. I imagine you would veer towards thinking that this has got something to do with it being an academy school. It's not just about finding somewhere as a playing ground for the children.
Well, back in, you know, when that particular piece of land, Cottam kind of was given it, if you like, because the land that they originally were using was given to Redland Green.
It's on a long lease, isn't it? 100
years, and at that time, both schools were under local authority control. We want this piece of land for Redland Green because that's a new school, and we're going to give you, Cottam, the bit down at Stoke Lodge. And that would be how it is. Since academisation has come round, the difference now is that the Cottam's relationship as an academy has changed with the local authority. So if the local authority wants or needs Cottam to do something for them, if you like expand because we need secondary school places, Cottam is in a position where...
Yeah, or share... For example.
Or share, yeah. Well, the land is Bristol's, though. It's Bristol's land, and that's undisputed. If the local authority needs one of its secondary schools to expand, which it does, because the local authority has to make sure there's a place for every child that it's responsible for, then an individual academy can refuse to do that. And I take the view that what's actually happened is Cottam has said, because they are expanding, we will expand Bristol, but we want you to sort that field out for us so that it's ours. That's my view. And at national level, the ministers are discussing changing planning laws so that schools can build housing for their staff. And I think that is really an interesting thing to be looking at.
There were certainly, I think it was even a decade ago, on that particular piece of land at Stoke Lodge, there was some sort of planning permission. It was some sort of attempt at getting planning permission for buildings.
There we go. Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that Cottam know that or that that's what Cottam's got in mind, but down the line, if it goes through as is, I would be shocked if 10 years from now there weren't houses on at least part of that land.
So anyway, the wonderful education landscape in Bristol continues to flourish with the Ofsted ratings declining in our local schools. So why is that? I mean, we were told it was because the education was difficult in Bristol because the local authority weren't making a very good job of it, and so we had to academise, privatise our schools, and actually, lo and behold, Ofsted ratings are going down.
Yes, they are, unfortunately. There have been a number of secondary schools that have been Ofsted recently that have come out with inadequate. So there are two in South Bristol, Merchants Academy and Bridge, that are both inadequate. City Academy remains inadequate, although it's been rebrokered and it's now run by the Cabot Learning Federation. It remains an inadequate provision until Ofsted go back in and say otherwise. And Henbury in North Bristol, as a part of our secondary school system, that's also unfortunately just been rated as inadequate by Ofsted. So part of this is the changing of the criteria that Ofsted are using to measure where a school is on its ratings. But fundamentally, what's happened is the academisation programme brought some physical infrastructure investment into the city that had an impact at a time when there was also more funding within the system. What has changed is those schools are now part of the normal environment, the normal landscape. Most of our schools have either been completely rebuilt or have had quite a lot of investment in across our sectors, and the funding has reduced year on year. There's been 8% real terms decrease in education funding since 2010.
So, I mean, can the schools just turn to the Ofsted inspectors and say, well, what do you expect if you keep cutting our funding?
It's not Ofsted. Ofsted aren't the funders. There's beginning to be...
Well,
yes,
I mean, there must be mitigating circumstances of some sort. If you're finding that you haven't got, for example, enough money to maintain classrooms and things like that.
The closest we've come to that is, did you see that the programme that was on recently called, I think it was called School, and it was based at Marwood, the Castle, and the Castle School out in South Gloucestershire. And it was a kind of, it was a year long, you know, they let the cameras into the secondary schools, and they had some serious conversations about funding, and you saw the real impact of the cuts on staffing levels and on the children. That was the closest that really I've seen my profession come to saying this is what's really going on. I think that head teachers are organised and are speaking out now in a way I've never known in my career. Over 20 years I've been in and around the education system.
Yeah, the NAHT, Teachers Union, has been very outspoken too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In the last couple of years, they really have galvanised their membership. Head teachers aren't the most radical of people. And usually they will they'll tread the line that they need to be treading. In the last couple of years, I've seen head teachers speaking out in a way that I've not as yet seen. I think we are heading for a crescendo with education funding. And I think that at a national level, it will head teachers saying, I haven't got the money for that. And actually saying that to Ofsted inspectors, this is the reason why I had to cut this, I had to cut that, I had to cut something else. This is the impact that it's had on my ability to provide the education.
So, I mean, how does Bristol, what's happened in Bristol, this recent decline, compare to the national picture?
Well, funding-wise, similar. The decline in the schools, specifically in Bristol, are a very unfortunate in the sense that there were a number of schools that were considered to be good or outstanding that hadn't been inspected for the best part of 10 years. So now the inspectors are going in, and what they found is that they're no longer good or outstanding, because there was a period of time whereby if a school was deemed to be very, very good, it didn't get re-inspected. And what that tells us actually is that you can't just say, well, that's an outstanding school, we're not going to go and have a look for another 10 years just because we look at their data and make sure that they're keeping their percentages up on what the children are attaining. There's so much more to what happens in a school than what is put out in league tables. So there's a number of schools that are in that situation, and there's also a number of schools whereby they've suffered because, in my view, the foundations of the academisation programme were built in sand, if you like, and now we're seeing that that is actually falling away. The fundamentals of our school system in Bristol have not changed. The children 20 years ago that were grouped together are still grouped together in the same schools. Do you understand? You know, it's kind of St. Mary Redcliffe is still taking children from across the city and beyond. And that results in a certain type of cohort. The same is true of Colston Girls. The same is true of the Cathedral. The bridge, what was Hartcliffe in South Bristol, still serves a very, very deprived community. And the fundamentals of that have not changed.
You're saying we've got a kind of elite, some elite schools in the city.
And that's exactly the same as what it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. Those fundamentals have not changed.
And is that just on ability? Age 11 or whatever?
It's about the environment in which children are growing up. It's about the aspirations that the children have. But it's also about why it is that the army, for example, is the institution that's been brought in to, so say, raise aspirations and attainment in South Bristol, whereas it's law firms in certain schools in the north. Now, that, to me, says everything about how we treat certain parts of our, you know, certain communities within our city, and that actually there are still issues around certain communities are expected to behave and do certain types of jobs, and in other parts of the city there's a different aspiration.
What would you like to see?
I would like to see our disadvantaged and vulnerable children being a lot more evenly spread around our schools. The institutions need to start pulling their weight. So there are certain, particularly at secondary school, there are certain schools in this city that need to start educating and making sure that within their cohorts they've got their share of disadvantaged or vulnerable children, and geographically it's possible to do that. It's just that the schools will not, partly because historically they haven't, but also because they know exactly the biggest influences on educational attainment for children, and that is the environment in which children are growing up in. And so they, you know, there are filters when they want to get through the door into the schools, and the filters are on, and that has the desired impact.
What about SEND funding? What's that?
Oh, so that's SEND is Special Educational Needs and Disabilities. Yeah. So it's the most vulnerable children. So it's those children who they may be in a special school. They may be educated by hospital education service. They may be in alternative provisions. But the vast majority of children with SEND are in the mainstream. And so they're under the SENCO, the Special Educational Needs Coordinator. That has had huge cuts, huge, huge cuts. And that is at a national level, but also at a local level.
Any results from, because we had a court case, didn't we, that the Lib Dems did here locally?
Yeah.
Also, JR.
The judicial review.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so there were some parents, Bristol parents. It was the first of its kind in the country. And they took our council to court last summer for a decision that the council took to cut 5 million out of the special educational needs budget locally, and the parents won, and it set case law and it set a legal precedent, and there are other local authorities that are now being taken to court as a result of that. There's another group of local authorities that changed their minds, if you like, about how they were going to deal with the pressures on their SEN funding issues. And it's also, I think, empowered a group of parents at a national level to take the government to court because they're saying you are putting these legal responsibilities on local authorities, but you're not actually funding them to a level whereby they're in a position to actually carry out those statutory duties. So it's started a chain of events whereby we've got we've got other local authorities, and things go happening at a national level.
Anything else?
No, that's it. Is that not enough?
Yes. Plenty. Fascinating. And how do we follow your stuff online, Christine?
Oh, probably on Twitter is the best place to find. Just look up my name, Christine Townsend, you'll find me. There's going to be a few things coming out, and there's an election quite soon, so people are kind of beginning to warm themselves up for that, shall we say?
An election?
The mayoral election, the council election.
Right, okay. Who's your favourite candidate then? Yourself? Are you going to stand again?
I am going to stand again.
Great.
It will be after Brexit, if there is ever such a time, but probably in the autumn things will start to, the parties themselves are kind of kicking off at the moment, aren't they?
Am I right in saying that you don't necessarily think you're going to win, but you'd like to win, but the main reason for doing it is just so that the other candidates are talking about these things?
Well, I pretty much know I'm not going to win. It's to make sure that education is, for the same reasons I said before, nothing has changed. In fact, it's got worse. And we're about to have a new secondary school in Lochlease, run by the Cathedral Trust, that is going to behave in exactly the same way as the secondary school that already runs in the centre of Bristol behaves.
But even if you were to become mayor, surely you'd be hamstrung because of the simple lack of funding.
Funding is an issue, but policy is also an issue. So it's a policy decision, for example, that means the cathedral school turns away Bristol resident children that apply and allocate places to children that live in North Somerset. That's a policy decision. It will bring costs down if they allocate those places to local children. The school they're going to build in Lochlease is going to prioritise children living in BS1. Because apparently children living in BS1 have difficulty getting a secondary school place. So they're refusing children that live where their first school is and saying, we'll solve the problem by building another one in Lochlease and then target the children that can't get places near our first school. But the issue with that is the only families that can actually use a school in Lochlease that live in BS1 are the ones that can fund the transport. And therein lies the filter. That's the filters that Cathedral School, Colston Girls School, the faith schools are very, very good at putting in front of families so that they control the nature of the cohort that comes into their schools.
Okay, thanks very much, Christine Townsend. Haven't had you here for a while, but a very useful contribution. Now, Ron, I can see you nodding away to some of that. Are there any quick fixes to education in this city? Because we have apparently a bit of a reputation of having not very good education in Bristol. And as you've just heard from Christine, this whole academy system doesn't really seem to have solved anything.
Well, I've only been living in Bristol for 6 months, so I don't have enough information, let alone expertise, as Christine does. But I want to reinforce what Christine said about special educational needs funding. I attended a scrutiny committee meeting of the Bristol City Council, and they're taking this issue so seriously that they're taking money from next year's budget to make sure that this year's special needs budget will be adequate. So I think they've learned their lesson. I think it's a question of resources. The whole academy experience basically is fragmented education in this country. It's led to a postcode lottery, so children are getting an uneven experience, which I think has to be addressed not only through resources, but I think, as Christine said, by policies as well.
Okay, let's go on to the international stuff now, though. And I'm going to start with looking at the German decision to follow the Brits this week to say, well, we have no problem using Huawei's technology in our country. The US is doing everything it can to stop Britain and other European countries from using this Chinese technology. And, of course, a couple of months ago, arrested the daughter of the Huawei boss from China. Now, it does seem, as I said at the top of the hour, it's almost as if there's an attempt to have a trade war here. But if you can't keep the Europeans on side, and actually, if you domestically are starting to lose, surely that trade war, you've already lost before you've even really started fighting it.
Well, I think this trade war, or particularly the arrest of the executive that you referred to earlier, I think is part of a tactic basically to put pressure on China to amend some of its practices, which some of the major American companies found very upsetting. And that is, China has had a policy of allowing investment from transnational corporations within its country as long as they shared that up-to-date technology. And many of these companies basically felt that that was violating their information rights, information property rights, and they were upset about that. So I think a lot of this is being gesturing, posturing. But there's also some of it has been a tactic to try to get the Chinese government to make certain concessions. I think a trade war already is hurting China. There's been a lower rate of growth in the Chinese economy. But I think the ripple effects will be felt within the United States very soon.
Do you think the U.S. is going to start having second thoughts about having a trade war?
I'm not quite sure. I think Trump basically has been more influenced by short-term political potential gains. He plays to his followers. He basically, in his campaign trail, he was emphasizing that, you know, that the Chinese were a threat to the U.S. economy. We had an unfavorable so-called trade balance with China, and that had to be corrected. He targeted China's basically unsavory practices. So I don't think he's actually thinking necessarily what's best for the American economy. I think he's thinking more best with, for his short-term political future.
Short-termism. Never really works, that one. Also, in the Telegraph this week, I thought fascinating article by David Millward, and he's saying Trump, the headline is, Russia feeds off Trump's trade war while the US Corn Belt farmers suffer. And this is really worrying, isn't it? If you're actually damaging your own farming industry by having this trade war. He starts, for more than 30 years, Joe Pfeiffer worked as a lawyer looking after farmers in Iowa at the heart of the U.S. Corn Belt. He was raised on a farm during the 80s, was a law clerk in a bankruptcy court during the last major U.S. agriculture crisis. Now he's watching history repeat itself with a wave of bankruptcies across the farm belt. Number of Chapter 12 bankruptcies, a mechanism that allows family farms to restructure their debts, surged last year as the country paid the price for overproduction at a time when rejuvenated Russia has supplanted the U.S. as the world's leading wheat exporter. So this is clearly one he can't win, Ron.
Well, you're quite right, because any attempt basically to impose tariffs on Chinese exports to the American market is going to be matched tit for tat by Chinese countermeasures. And this is hurting, obviously, American producers.
But this is Russians, mainly. Russians that are
Russians are picking up the slack. That's the whole point. The Russians are filling the void and at the expense of American farmers. But, as I said before, Trump is thinking about short-term political gains. He has not looked at the larger picture.
Isn't this his base? These are people that voted for him, surely, and he's and as he's saying there, there's a record number of bankruptcies.
That's exactly right. So basically, what I'm basically saying is that his motive was to protect his political base. His actual decisions could be counterproductive, and I think he'll pay a very high cost if he does run for re-election in 2020.
In other words, he'd lose.
Well, he will lose some of the support from his base if these measures are not taken, basically, to address the bankruptcies that you're referring to.
Well, we've seen various other stories over the last few weeks, but we've heard just literally in the last couple of days that are actually going to be 200 troops left in Syria after the U.S. pulls out of Syria. Do you actually think that it was the U.S. that defeated ISIS, or was it The Turks or the Russians or the Syrians or the Iranians?
About the Kurds. I mean, it's always, you know, that was an example of collaborative efforts because I think all those countries, all those peoples recognized the threat posed by ISIS. So it was a collective effort. You know, it wasn't just one country that could take the credit for it. But it's very interesting how the United States has tried to massage this U-turn. They're referring to these 200 troops as peacekeepers. I'm not quite sure if the people who inhabit the villages, which were at the vortex of the armed conflict between ISIS and the other forces, would consider the United States forces as being peacekeepers.
We've also seen Putin this week. I think it was last week, wasn't it? He had his big press conference. Putin is saying that this week that Russia is militarily ready for another Cuban-style missile crisis. He said Russia is seeking naval delivery vehicles to counter all the US deployments, following warnings on Wednesday this week that Russia intends to respond to any attempts to deploy nuclear missiles in Europe. Russian President Vladimir Putin adding that his nation is militarily ready for any kind of Cuban-style missile crisis if the US wants one.
Well, that's very alarming news because anything that increases the temperature, so to speak, of relations between the United States and Russia or between NATO and Russia is very, very scary. I think the U.S. decision to pull out of the nuclear agreement with Russia was not necessarily aimed at Russia. It was actually aimed at China. I think the United States basically feels much more threatened by the ascendancy of China as not only as an economic power, but as a political force within international relations. And basically, it's turning its attention basically to trying to counter what they perceive as a Chinese threat.
It goes back in a way to this conversation we were having earlier about Jacinda Ardern, actually, and Morrison is the Australian guy, following Germany and the UK in saying it's okay to use this Chinese technology. Actually, this technology is potentially hackable. It's potentially a military style technology. So it's almost as if trying to ban this kind of technology, the US is saying, well, we're actually getting ready for a war. Do you think that's feasible?
Well, I was reading an article, I think it was on Counterpunch, which actually said the United States is already at war with China. And I think there's a great deal of credence to that argument.
Well, there's different types of war, aren't there?
That's exactly right. It's not necessarily a military conflict. It's basically more diplomatic and economic and trying to isolate
psychological,
China.
Psychological, too.
And trying to isolate China, yes.
Is that feasible to do that? I mean, surely propaganda. You can't just win a war on that and economic warfare alone.
Yes, you're quite right. But you have to understand American foreign policy, particularly since the end of the Cold War. It came as a destabilizing force to American foreign policy because the Cold War provides certain degree of certainty to policymakers in the United States. They had what they seemed to be a boogeyman, a threat, i.e. Communism, or particularly led by the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union collapsed after 1991, they were trying to search for another enemy. so to speak, because obviously you have a military industrial complex to feed within the United States. And that enemy basically seemed to be possibly the threat of international terrorism. Now it's being replaced by China.
Well, there's also the film, a film by John Pilger called The Coming War with China, which is well worth looking up. It was actually on ITV, I think, a couple of years ago, one sort of Thursday evening, which really looks at certain... for example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when there were orders to launch nuclear missiles against the Chinese, and the Americans in charge of the missiles said, well, we're not going to launch them because this war is not with China. Or at least this threat in Cuba is not from China, it's from Russia. And you do wonder quite what's going on when there seems to have been a false order come through to launch a nuclear missile against China. So fascinating to watch that, a bit of the history. And then also about the preparations, apparent preparations nations around the Pacific that there are for military threats against China. So this is, you know, it would be nice if they could start sitting down and talking rather than doing a kind of Trump-North Korea art of the deal thing. Because what happens when you do the art of the deal is you... This is Trump's book, is it's brinkmanship. And when you're doing brinkmanship on nuclear war... I think you should not really be doing that. You can do brinkmanship on most things, but when it's nuclear war, you should be thinking twice. Anyway, let's have a listen now, because one of the things I mentioned Huawei there again, and a lot of the dispute about this Huawei technology between the Chinese, the Australians, the Germans, the Brits, etc., has been over this 5G network. And there's a lot of people having to educate themselves very, very quickly about what 5G actually is. It's not like a normal data network, but these kinds of transmitters are now across the UK, and Bristol's one of the first cities to do this, being installed in lampposts across the city. So I just picked up from a few weeks ago a guy called Dr. Martin Paul over in the United States, who was giving evidence on 5G to one of their congressional committees. So let's have a listen to that. Pretty shocking stuff.
5G will entail the use of much higher frequencies and pulsations than our current microwave devices. The much higher pulsations allow 5G to carry much more information. But basically, because of these high frequencies and high pulsations, the biological effects, I predict, will be much, much greater because of the activation of the VGCCs. The other problem with 5G is they're planning to put out tens of millions of these antennae all over the place, so that it'll be almost impossible to avoid exposures. You get endocrine effects, and a large number of different endocrine effects. As far as I can tell, every single hormone system in the body is impacted. And there are 12 reviews regarding hormonal effects. You get excessive intracellular calcium. And this, as you'll find out later, is the cause of almost everything that I'll talk about. So this is the underlying cause behind everything else. There's cancer. There are 35 reviews on cancer causation by EMFs. And it includes everything that goes on in the whole process of carcinogenesis. Now, pulsed EMFs, EMFs that pulse up and down, are in most cases much more biologically active than our non-pulsed or what are called continuous wave EMFs. And that's been shown in 13 different reviews. Because all wireless communication devices communicate via pulsations, they are potentially and I believe actually much more dangerous. There are several other effects for which there is strong evidence, but not the kind of overwhelming evidence that we talked about before. There are cardiac effects that affect the electrical control of the heart. They are life-threatening. There's also evidence for very early onset Alzheimer's and other dementias, and those are obviously very consequential. We also get ADHD and autism, apparently caused by late prenatal and early postnatal EMF exposures. It's my opinion that these are caused by the effects of intracellular calcium on the development of the synapses during the early development of the brain. The current plan, which has already been approved by the U.S. Congress and the FCC, is to put out tens of millions of these 5G antennae, irradiating every single person and every other organism in the whole country without even a single biological safety test of genuine 5G radiation. This is, in my judgment, absolutely insane. Thank you very much.
Well, as there are people around the city who are involved in campaigning for and against this. I mean, if you look at the press coverage, though, Ron, it's been very gushing, saying things like, oh, aren't Bristol lucky that we've managed to secure this wonderful new technology as a sort of test bed. It's actually the West of England Combined Authority which has secured £5 million from the government to trial this super-fast 5G network at tourist destinations in Bristol and Bath, they say. A trial will see 5G infrastructure put in place at the Roman Baths in Bath, the M Shed, and around the We the Curious and the Millennium Square in Bristol. The Metro Mayor Tim Bowles is saying wonderful things about it, but actually some of the professionals are saying this technology could be dangerous to our health.
Well, if you're talking about a trial basically needs to assess the potential environmental and health impacts that this technology might have. Without doing that, a trial basically is not worth the word trial, because at the end of the day, it's not something that a technology might serve a particular purpose, but you also have to look at the unintended consequences of that technology.
Do you think that we've got sufficient regulation, both here and in the US, for against these mobile networks? Because we know, don't we, that the governments now make a tremendous amount of income from licensing the mobile providers. And I wonder whether they are as rigorous as they should be about the health effects of microwaves.
Well, I think you're quite right. I think, once again, they're thinking in terms of income generation and not thinking about, again, the possible unintended consequences it might have on the health of the population.
There's in Gateshead, up in Liverpool, there's been another one of these trials last year, and Mark Stevens has worked in the military with microwave technology. He's very, very nervous there, and he's had some success in stopping various trials up in Gateshead, in basically going along to the council meetings and getting planning committees, etc., to say no to planning permission for these things because there hasn't been enough safety testing. Although some say he's alarming, he certainly deserves to be heard. So let's have a listen now to Mark Stevens talking about the potential biological effects of 5G and other microwave technologies.
Short-term memory loss, ringing in the ears, sore eyes, bleeding from the nose. There's a number of things that were, you know, just a unwellness, shoulder pain, joint pain, shoulder pain, lethargy. And all these things are attributed to microwave radiation. We've seen it in Gateshead. We had 5G rolled out covertly and in secret. The council are still in denial, even though I'm an expert and I know exactly what 5G is, and they most certainly have 5G here. That technology has caused nosebleeds, miscarriage. We've got, you know, people bleeding, you know, brain tumours. The amount of people that are dying in the area of brain cancer now are absolutely unprecedented. And we have people bleeding in the brain. Lots and lots of very strange cancers, heart cancers, very interesting thing. Radar operators get it. It's very, very rare. We've got a couple of children here who've been reported to have this. And we're talking about cancers that, you know, you'd probably see one in, you know, a couple of 100,000 maybe, where this is, you know, I've got two children not living far from me who've developed a heart cancer. There's not even 100,000 people in Gateshead, and these people are only a couple of miles from me. So something very, very strange going on. Microwave radiation is a class 1 cancer-causing radiation, period. Science is out. NTP study, Ramzini Institute, and a recent study came out of Israel where this type of phased array battlefield interrogation, because that's what it is, it's battlefield interrogation technology, unfitted to street lighting, and it has been shown to be a class 1 cancer-causing radiation. So that's, you know, that's what you eventually get. But in the meanwhile, it causes neurological disorders where people want to self-harm. People basically don't know what's going on. They're waking up in the middle of the night, so they suffer insomnia. People start feeling well, start having panic attacks. Now, if I was to tell somebody that you were in this soup and you knew what the cause was, then that illness, that potential for people self-internalising the mental anguish that they're going through, where they commit suicide, would most certainly be alleviated. However, people are left with the thought that they believe it is them. When they go to the doctors and ask for help, doctor will ask you, what's wrong with you? If I was to tell you, you know, that's like me turning around to a guy who's had his leg blew off, coming into a surgery, and he's hopping along, and me saying, well, what's wrong? Why are you hopping? Well, I can see he's got one of his legs blown off. What you can't see is the brain injury that people suffer from this type of microwave radiation. And that then leads to significant mental health, detrimental health issues. And we've got doctors who prescribe drugs don't tell people what the cause is for in some inexplicable reason. In fact, I think the Lancet did an article recently. So GPs should be starting to get up to speed that the toxicity and the illnesses that they're starting to see exhibited in their surgeries are due to microwave radiation.
Well, that's his point of view. We don't necessarily agree with it. But the fact of the matter is, Ron, that we've had in this country, as you have to a certain extent in the United States, a bit of a bonfire of the regulations. And now this sort of technology, what he's pointing out there, actually hasn't been adequately tested at all. And he's also uses quite an interesting expression to describe it, like a kind of being in an electronic soup.
I don't know what you meant by that, but I think, how do you test the technology to make sure that it's safe? I'm not quite sure. I'm not a scientist. It'd be interesting to see what other scientists might have to say about this technology. But the analogy I was trying to think of is how pharmaceuticals and medicines are licensed to be used for to the public. They have to go through stringent criteria and testing protocol before they are. And even when they are, every time you take medication, you always have a sheet of paper that says possible side effects. Gives you guidance, and if you're taking medication A, you might want to not take this medication because it might have untold damage for you.
Yeah, I mean, for example, we've got this vaccine in Fanrixhexa, which is now given to children. They're advised to have it. They're told it's safe. The parents are obviously, the children don't get much of a say in it when they're 8 weeks old. There's an Indian report, which is in part of the European Union medical website, that says that in India they found that this vaccine can cause unexpected death. And on the NHS website, it says this vaccine is safe. So it's rather worrying that maybe we're not getting 100%. Talking about vaccines. But look, let's get back to the 5G network, which has been rolled out here in Bristol. And first, I think, to understand what this is, there are little transmitters which are being put into the top of lampposts, so you wouldn't necessarily even know they're there. But certainly Mark Stevens is very much aware that they are. And he thinks that they're, as he's someone that's worked on weapon systems, this was originally a military technology. It was designed for communicating on the battlefield.
They've got 31,875 just in Gated. Got a few million across the country, I'd suggest, because I've got them in Sheffield, London. I was in Kensington last week. I've got them in. Got some really most equipment has the ability, the capability to backhaul all the data out of every device in your home. So your smart TV, your smart whatever's smart, they can actually pick up the data from that. It's basically just a blanket coverage in your locality, and I can pick out every single device that you have in your home.
So anyway, so it's something which is actually not just hanging around. It's also interrogating things like your fridge, possibly, or your toaster, if you've got a smart toaster. So let's just move on now anyway, Ron, to talk about David Icke. What do you make of this chap? He's written lots of books. He's called a conspiracy theorist. He believes that there's some sort of reptilian bloodline, and he's now been banned from going to Australia.
I'm not really familiar with him. Can you give me more background information?
Well, let's have a little listen to him. Here he is on Australian television, and here he is just speaking a couple of days ago.
What on earth is a so-called democracy allowing itself to use methods of tyrannies to shut down debate? We have thousands of Australians from all walks of life, of every age. When I spoke in Sydney last time, the age range was 15 to 90, who have bought tickets to make a decision, to hear what I've got to say and then come to conclusions on what they hear, who now are being denied that right.
Do you believe that the world is being manipulated by shape-shifting reptiles that are possibly Jews who control the world through Rothschild? Is that...
There are family bloodlines that were seeded all over the world, and the ancient cultures.
By whom?
The ancient cultures, well, by a non-human force. This is where you get in the Bible, for instance, the sons of God who interbred with the daughters of men, which is a story that you find in cultures all over the world,
so
whether it's the African culture or whatever.
People all over the world a long time ago, and yeah. they are resulting in being human forms,
yeah.
and they are lizards.
I'm saying that these bloodlines were seeded everywhere, in every culture. Mm. So where's this, their Jews
what did they
come
take?
From?
Do you believe millions of Jewish people were rounded up, shot, gassed during the war? Yes or no? Millions, yes.
Did millions of people die in the concentration camps? Yes.
Okay, and do you know who the reptilians are? Do you actually know in today's society who the reptiles are, who were seeded long ago and it's come through the generations? Do you know their names?
People would have to read my books for the details.
Okay, I'll get your book today and I'll have a crack at it. But can you just give me one?
You can't do this in sound bites.
Yeah, but can you get...
I know some of them.
Well, I'm asking you, do you know who they are? Are they in positions
of
high rank?
Yes, they are. They're in positions of power, absolutely.
Are they Jewish people who work for the Rothschild organisation?
Some of them are. Most of them aren't. So again, you know, when you're talking about a range of people from a range of backgrounds, why suddenly, because you mention someone who's Jewish, is that kind of, oh, no, you're anti-Semitic? Why aren't I anti-Chinese and anti-American and anti-British and anti-French when I name people from those countries? Mm. It's crazy. Mm. And so this is what happens when you
we have heard
a situation
where... You've said that about seven or eight times. Got it, David? I got to say, I'm with Sarah. I believe if people are crazy enough to pay money to hear you speak, you should be allowed to. That
right.
is called free speech.
Well, people are crazy enough to listen to this program every morning. How crazy can you get?
Yay! Woo, woo, woo! Indeed. David Icke, thanks
point.
For joining us.
So, what do you reckon, Ron? Should he have his visa given by the Australians to go and speak over there?
Well, I think he'll expose himself as a charlatan and he'll be discredited. So I don't see what benefit would be to prevent him from speaking.
Thanks. Well, Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro, we'll have him next week. Didn't have time for him. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests. That's Lib Dem Councillor for Noel, Gary Hopkins. Labour Councillor for Ashley, Mike Davis. Former teacher, Christine Townsend, also maybe Zucci from Protect Our NHS.
BCFM.
You'll find this show's podcast, story links, and comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter and Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Please do join us on the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show, we're joined by two experts on the New Deal for a conversation about the history of these Depression-era set of policies and how that history can inform us about today's talk of a Green New Deal. Our guests are Gray Brecken and Richard Walker, both from the New Deal Project hosted at UC Berkeley. Gray Brecken is the author of the book Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. Richard Walker is the author of the book Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. We'll talk about what the New Deal did, the politics behind it, and the 50-year effort to destroy it. Gray Brecken and Richard Walker join us next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. The House Oversight Committee has launched an investigation into claims by several whistleblowers that senior White House officials pushed a project to share nuclear power technology with Saudi Arabia despite the objections of ethics and national security officials. Lawmakers from both parties have expressed concerns that Saudi Arabia could develop nuclear weapons if the U.S. technology were transferred without proper safeguards. The congressional report raised concern about whether some in a White House marked by chaos, dysfunction, and backbiting sought to circumvent national security procedures to push a Saudi deal that could financially benefit close supporters of the president. Silicon Valley Democrat Ro Khanna told Democracy Now! This is a very serious matter.
Here's why people should care. The Saudis have been giving arms to Al-Qaeda in Yemen. There's reports of that. And the last thing we want to do as a country is to transfer nuclear secrets to Saudi Arabia, which could lead to proliferation and a threat to our security. And as the journalist you have on has reported, there's a lot of financial conflict of interest here. Tom Barrack, who headed up the president's inaugural committee to raise $100 million plus, is also pushing for this deal and has financial interests in the deal.
The congressional report says the nuclear effort was pushed by former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who was fired in early 2017. The New York Times reports that Flynn worked on the issue for the company promoting the nuclear export deal and kept pushing it once inside the White House. It has remained under consideration by the Trump administration. Iran likely would be most at threat from a nuclear Saudi Arabia. In a reference to murdered Saudi columnist Jamal Khashoggi, Iran's foreign minister tweeted, quote, first a dismembered journalist, now illicit sale of nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia fully expose U.S. hypocrisy. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled unanimously that the Constitution's ban on excessive fines applies to the states. The outcome could help efforts to rein in police seizure of property from criminal suspects. Police departments around the country finance their operations with the lucrative property seizures. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the court's opinion in favor of Tyson Timbs of Marion, Indiana. Police seized Timbs' $40,000 Land Rover when they arrested him for selling about $400 worth of heroin. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned the Trump administration against deploying new nuclear missiles in Europe. In his State of the Nation address, Putin said that if the U.S. goes ahead, Russia will retaliate by fielding new weapons that will take just as little time to reach their targets. Putin's remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera.
Russia will be forced to create and develop weapons that can be used not only towards those territories that threaten us directly, also against the decision-making centers that are behind the missile systems which threaten us.
Intermediate-range nuclear weapons are particularly destabilizing as they take a shorter time to reach their targets compared to intercontinental ballistic missiles. That would leave practically no time for decision-makers, raising the likelihood of a global nuclear conflict over a false launch warning. Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign reports raising $4 million in the 12 hours after the Democratic Socialist Senator from Vermont announced he will run for president again. The average donation was $27, as it was during Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. That's more than double the amount raised by California Senator Kamala Harris in the 24 hours after she announced her presidential bid. Snow's beginning to fall in New York City. Federal offices and schools in Washington, D.C. and several parts of the U.S. are closed or delaying their starts amid predictions for storms. The Washington area airports are experiencing significant flight cancellations. Snow forced Minneapolis and St. Paul's schools and scores of other districts in Minnesota and Wisconsin to cancel classes. Northern Arizona is bracing for heavy snowfall in the coming days. Heavy rains are also causing problems in parts of the Deep South. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Over the next few weeks, this radio program plans to bring you a series of conversations on the Depression-era New Deal and also on historic labor strikes over the past 120 years or so. Tomorrow, we're going to be in conversation with labor journalist and historian Steve Early to talk about the Bread and Roses strike of 1912. It was a strike that was led by immigrant textile women workers and organized by the industrial workers of the world. And I was struck when about a week and a half ago, Elizabeth Warren, in her official campaign announcement for president, gave a detailed account of this strike right at the very top. And so it struck me that a serious presidential candidate would begin her announcement speech with a story about a strike that was organized by the Wobblies. So that's tomorrow. Interesting times we're going into, especially as now Bernie Sanders has made it official that he's running for president too. Today, I have the great opportunity to spend this hour with two friends who I've learned a great deal from over the years about many things and no less about the Great Depression era New Deal, a set of programs meant to stabilize the financial markets, put people back to work, build infrastructure, and I would argue defend off fascism here at home. Though I'm not the expert on this issue, but my two guests are Gray Brecken and Richard Walker. Gray Brecken is the founder and project scholar of the Living New Deal, hosted by UC Berkeley Department of Geography. He is the author of the book Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. And Richard Walker is the founder and director of that same very program, the Living New Deal, out of UC Berkeley. And Richard Walker is the author of the book, his latest one, Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. Gray Brecken, Richard Walker, my very good pleasure to welcome you back to this program. Frequently, I speak to you individually, but to have you both here today at the same time is a great pleasure. Thank you.
Lovely to be back. And by the way, I'm not the founder of the Living New Deal, Gray is, but
Did I call you the founder?
I'm the administrative guru. And
oh, you're
Gray,
more than
Gray
that.
Is the inspirational.
Well, we're going to have to talk to whoever wrote these introductory remarks. Usually I do, but maybe they got lost in translation. Okay, gentlemen, the New Deal. Let's talk about what it was. Oftentimes we say it as the New Deal is a singular thing, but this was a series of policies over the years. Talk to me about it.
Well, I mean, it's really important to talk about what the New Deal actually did, because now that we're talking about Green New Deal, yeah, and it's very, very ambitious, we should look and see. First, we should say, well, you know, we did something like that before, so it's absolutely possible. And that's perhaps the greatest lesson of the New Deal.
And that's interesting, because I watch a lot of CNN when I'm getting ready in the morning to come to work. I just have it on the TV as I'm getting dressed and eating breakfast, whatever. And what I constantly hear on there, and you know, it's fair to say it's a very anti-Trump kind of a network now. But what I constantly hear when this issue of the Green New Deal comes up is, how are we going to pay for it? We can't do everything.
Oh, yeah. That's the usual shtick. But the New Deal, like the Green New Deal, was very ambitious. It did an immense array of things that we can talk about. And the paying for it, look, the paying for it, if you tax the rich and tax the corporations up to, you know, it reached 90% marginal tax rate in the 1950s. And during the 30s, I think it was up in the 70s, you can actually generate a lot of money. And then there is, of course, deficit and bond financing, which we do all the time. You know, I mean, that's what the Republican tax cuts have done, is a massive deficit boost to the current economy. Well, deficit spending is something that you weren't supposed to do, but Roosevelt did it anyway. And it turned out it actually is absolutely necessary in a recession or a depression to get the economy moving again.
Didn't Roosevelt at the very beginning, though, of his first term actually try to balance the budget? Wasn't he describing to those type of
Yeah, he actually believed economics? In balanced budgets, because everyone did.
Yeah, and economists just like now. Did.
And as usual, you know, the conventional wisdom is, oh, you know, we can't do that. We can't do this or that. But he knew that people were desperate, and at desperate times called for desperate measures. So he just moved ahead. And actually, one of his few blunders was in 37, 38, they decided to balance the budget again, and it helped trigger a very sharp recession. Mm. And then they said, uh-oh, big mistake, went back to heavy spending on relief and works projects and so on, and the economy took off again.
And remember also that, you know, just a few weeks before he was inaugurated in March of 1933, the Great Depression was at absolute pit. it was at its worst because at that point, the banks were going down like dominoes. And this is before FDIC, which is a New Deal program. So if you had your money
FDIC,
in a bank.
This is insurance.
That's right.
The banks,
yeah. It's the federal insurance, which is was set up to guarantee that we would never have a bank panic like that again. So that if you had your life savings in a bank and it closed its doors, you were out of luck. There was no social safety net. So Roosevelt, when he came in, he realized he had to do something to save the economy. When he said in his first inaugural, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, he meant the terror that people felt because it seemed like there was absolutely no bottom to the Depression.
That's interesting because everybody knows that quote about fear.
Yes.
I think most people probably think of it dealing with World War II or something.
Oh, no.
Exactly. Right. Uh-huh. No, I mean, people did not know what to do. The leadership was bankrupt, the Hoover administration, conventional leadership. The Republicans had no idea. Business had no idea what to do. As the Depression plunged deeper and deeper and the bank, more and more banks were failing. You know, you ended up with thousands of banks failing. GDP fell by a third. Unemployment went up to a quarter of the workforce. And even then, wages had been cut on average by 40%. So if people were still working, they were barely hanging on so they could survive. So it was really catastrophic. The sense of it was catastrophic. And in Europe, of course, they turned in Italy and Germany and Spain turned to fascism. And Roosevelt, in fact, was encouraged even by liberals, like Walter Lippmann, to seize greater power. And he said, I'm not going to do that. You know, I'm going to use Congress. He had a huge mandate in the election of 32. So when he came in, he had the majorities in Congress, and he knew he could, but he had to move quickly, and that's what they did. They passed literally, I don't know, in the first 100 days, it was dozens of pieces of legislation. And so they got the thing going very fast. They didn't wait around.
And, you know, this is relevant to the Green New Deal. He also realized that what people really wanted and needed was a bold vision. He said this, you know. Yeah. They didn't want tinkering around. It wouldn't have worked. Hoover, the previous president, had this religious belief that the market would self-correct despite the enormous pain and possible civil war that might happen because of that. Roosevelt realized that you had to do something that would really inspire people. And that's what the New Deal did.
Yeah, this is a virtue of the Green New Deal resolution that AOC and Markey introduced. It's extraordinarily ambitious. But that gives you this sense of a national renewal, of a national project. And people want that. I mean, they get, you know, look at Trump's Make America Great Again.
Yeah.
It does appeal to some sense that people want a feeling that they're participating in something greater than themselves. They're participating in a national project. And a Green New Deal, like the New Deal, has to be nothing less than a national renewal, national reconstruction project. That's what the New Deal did, and that's what we need again today.
Yeah, Roosevelt seems to have been partly inspired, certainly in setting up the Civilian Conservation Corps, which we'll talk about, by an inspirational speech that the philosopher William James gave at Stanford just shortly after the 1906 earthquake destroyed San Francisco.
Some people call William James one of the founders of modern-day psychology.
That's right, yeah. Yes, and the brother of Henry James.
Yes.
Henry James? Yes.
Yeah, the writer.
Yeah. That it's called the moral equivalent of war. The moral equivalent of war. And so Roosevelt and the people he gathered around themselves, like Harold Ickes and Harry Hopkins and others, constantly said that the fight against the Depression was the equivalent of war, except that it was constructive rather than destructive. And it certainly was. And so that's what we need today, because the existential crisis that we're facing with climate disruption requires the moral equivalent of war to address and to rally people and unify them in the way that the Second World War did.
Yeah, it's really undergirding. If you know, you can get into the nuts and bolts, which we will, what the New Deal did and what a Green New Deal might do. But that sense, it has to be undergirded by this sense that This is a moral project. This is for the public good. It's a public project. It's public service. The people who lead it believe in public service and not personal gain and private gain. And they were incorruptible as a result. And that's really important sense. People felt they were participating in something that was bigger than them and that something was good, good and clean and ethical and kind of a higher calling.
On this idea of how do you pay for it? We can't pay for all these things. Let's put ourselves back in the shoes of people who were living in 1932 and 1933. And I'm sure this must have been an argument then, because what happened with these New Deal policies, and again, doesn't all come at once. It comes over a series of years, and we'll talk about what those were. But I've heard this described as the greatest expansion of what government does in people's everyday lives in the history of civilization. Suddenly you have Social Security. You were hitting on this earlier, Gray.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before you didn't have Social Security. You didn't have these safety net type of programs. So what the New Deal did was it dramatically changed the role of government in public life.
In the United States.
In the United mm-hmm. States. And so they must have been arguing at the time that we can't pay for this. This is beyond what government can do.
Oh, no, that's absolutely right. And as I said earlier, they started spending and, full speed ahead and figure out, all right, that if that stimulates the economy. And there is truth to this idea. You've heard it in silly ways from Trump or from Reagan back 40 years ago that, spending will pay for itself. But if you're in a massive recession, as the U.S. was, and massive depression, spending does pay for itself. And John Maynard Keynes, a great economist, proved that later, but they did it sort of by the seat of their pants. But it worked out because they pumped money back into the economy, got into people's hands. You were getting wages into workers' hands. They were spending it, and that, of course, makes for business. Makes for more commerce. They also, a very important thing they did before this and along with the spending projects was to clean up the banking and financial system. And with the collapse of 29 and the collapse of the banks, you'd actually flushed out a lot of the waste, the wasted money, the wasted capital that was just floating around in the financial sphere. And that's some problem we have today. A huge percentage of the economy, too big a percentage, is just money sloshing around doing nothing good for anyone. So they put that money to work, and they got the banks functioning.
How did they deal with that kind of money back in the 1930s?
Well, you restored – the stock market, of course, had collapsed then, and the property markets had collapsed. So that had cleaned out a lot of speculation. And then – they put the banks on a solid basis again, and they prevented the banks, commercial banks and investment banks, from working, being merged. So that was Glass-Steagall regulations. So they put these firewalls around the misbehaving part of the financial sector. At the same time, the kind of finance that would stimulate the economy and help ordinary people, like farm loans, home loans, and other kinds of basic credit, were themselves aided and stimulated, and new programs put in place to keep people from losing their homes, to help, which we didn't do in 2009 and 10, by the way, allow people to stay in their homes and allow them to buy homes and farmers to save their farms and so on and so on.
It's said that Roosevelt and these New Deal policies saved capitalism.
Yes, actually, and it was attacked from the left for that very reason, actually, because there were many on the left who actually believed that we should have had a revolution at that time. And Roosevelt, who had been a lawyer on Wall Street after he graduated from Harvard, he knew the system very well. He did not want to see it destroyed. And he was always kind of bemused that actually his class hated him so much and considered him a traitor to the class for saving capitalism from what it had done to itself.
And they did hate him.
Oh, they hated him.
As well.
Guts. Yeah.
He was hated by both sides, in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, I mean, when we were young, the left version was, well, this saved capitalism. We could have had a revolution. It isn't at all clear that America would have had any kind of a progressive revolution.
It could have very well gone the other way.
It could have gone the other way. And when you look back at it from today's perspective, after 40, 50 years of neoliberalism, it was a revolution. I mean, it revolutionized so many parts of American life, American government. Yes, government got bigger. The federal government came to play a much bigger role in funding local governments and overseeing programs across the country. But is that a bad thing? It can be if it's not done well, but the New Deal did it very well.
Yeah. It's funny when we talk about how a revolution could have just as easily went to the right, maybe into fascism during this period of time, as it had in Europe. And in studying fascism in Europe, you really get the sense and learn of how important disaffected World War I veterans were in those movements, how Mussolini relied on them, how Adolf Hitler, who was a World War I veteran himself, as was Mussolini, relied on World War I veterans. Here in the United States, during the Great Depression, as you both know, in 1932, we had World War I veterans march to Washington, D.C. and camp out on the National Mall. It was known as the Bonus Army, and they were requesting that the government give them their bonuses early because, well, they were struggling in the Great Depression. Herbert Hoover calls on Douglas MacArthur and the U.S. Army to go attack them and drives them out and burns down their cities. A few months later, Roosevelt takes over, it's now in the White House. A second Bonus Army returns. And I'm thinking, if you think about what happened to that first Bonus Army, this is rife. You could exploit this for fascist tendencies, I guess. What happens with FDR, and I guess it was Eleanor Roosevelt, actually greets them, gives them sandwiches, gives them coffee, and many of these World War I veterans were some of the first employees of these new government work programs.
Of the Civilian Conservation Corps, yes.
Mm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were given jobs, which is what they wanted.
So that's what I meant in my introduction. Yeah, and that's what I meant in my introduction is made perhaps fended off fascism at home.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think people today don't realize how many people were given jobs. You had 15 million unemployed, and the New Deal programs like the WPA and the CCC ended up employing, not all at one time, but overall, something like 12 to 15 million people. So it brought in veterans, young people who had no prospects, and older workers who were unemployed, skilled workers, and it put them to work on useful public projects. So you had a combination in the New Deal of defense of labor rights, the right to organize, minimum wage, a 40-hour work week, and so on, and then putting people to work and utilizing their skills on what they clearly could see was useful work. If you were in the CCC, you knew you were helping to restore the country's natural environment and open up parks and so on. If you were in the WPA, you were rebuilding local community structures, schools and parks and civic centers and so on. And so it wasn't just make work, as some people think. It was rebuilding the infrastructure of the country and giving people meaning to their lives at the most elemental level. What is the work day? What are you doing in your work?
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation about the Depression-era New Deal. My guests are Gray Brecken and Richard Walker. They are both with the Living New Deal program that's hosted at UC Berkeley Department of Geography. Gray Brecken is the author of the book Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin, and Richard Walker is the author of the book Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. Gentlemen, give me just one moment here because I'm going to take this quick break from our conversation because we are in our winter 2019 fund drive. This radio program is 100% dependent on the generosity of our listeners. So periodically, I come to you asking for a financial contribution that you can afford, one that's reasonable for you, one that is according to your own means. Now, I used to come to these fund drives seeking that contribution with a bit of hesitation, a bit of apprehension even. But I grew out of that because this is the heart of this great tradition of public broadcasting, listener support. So now in these drives, what we try to do, especially on this radio program, is put our best foot forward and bring you something that we hope is really worthwhile. And I think we are doing that today. In this really exciting political time when there is a lot of talk about a Green New Deal, I think it's worthwhile to take a step back and look at what the original New Deal was and why it's important to know about it today. So during our fund drives, we want to give you something worth tuning into. And what I'm asking in response is, again, a contribution that you can afford, one that's according to your means. The way we make this work is if people can contribute what they can according to their means, we'll make this work. For some folks, that's $25 or $50. For other people, it might be $500 or even $1,000. Whatever you could do, that's how we make this happen. The phone number is 1-800. Let me clarify something, because we're on both in the San Francisco Bay Area and also in Los Angeles on KPFK. So I actually have two phone numbers to give you. If you're listening to KPFA in Northern California or kpfa.org, our phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge online at kpfa.org. And in Los Angeles, you could dial 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. And just quickly, if you are looking for a thank you gift, we have a couple of them. One, the brand new Letters in Politics New Deal and Historic Labor Strike Collection. It's 18 interviews ranging on everything from what we did yesterday on the history of socialism in America, conversation we're having today with Gray Brecken and Richard Walker on the New Deal, the conversation we're going to have tomorrow on the Bread and Roses Strike of 1912, and just a whole lot of other programs based on this stuff. That is yours for a pledge of $100. We're also offering a book on the history of the New Deal. It's called The New Deal, A Modern History, and it's written by Michael Hiltzik, someone we talked to many years ago about that book, and I enjoyed it very much and found it informative. We're offering that book for a pledge of $100. So the book, The New Deal, A Modern History, yours for a pledge of $100, and the Letters and Politics New Deal and Historic Labor Strike Collection, $100. Get them together at the discounted rate of $175. The phone number again, 1-800-439-5732. If you're listening to KPFA in Northern California, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. Or for Los Angeles, the number 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. Gentlemen, forgive me for that. That was long-winded, but we have to do these every now and then to make sure that we can keep doing programs like this one.
Absolutely necessary. I pony up every year.
I know. So I see both of your names frequently, so I'm very thankful to you for all the support that you've given this radio station over the year. Thank you. Gray Brecken, something I find interesting, and you made me hip to this before the conversation. We're talking about the Green New Deal today that they're talking about in Congress. You would argue that you could call the old New Deal the old Green New Deal, that there was some serious environmental aspects.
Absolutely.
To these set of problems.
The historian Doug Brinkley has written a recent book that I recommend to everybody called Rightful Heritage. And it shows that Franklin Roosevelt was our greatest environmental president. He had previously thought, when he wrote a book about his distant cousin, Teddy Roosevelt, that Teddy was the greatest, but Franklin turns out to be even greater. That's largely...
Now, for Teddy Roosevelt, we think of the parks, the nationalizing of the parks and of the land and the protecting the land. What did FDR do?
Well, Teddy gets it going. Franklin actually vastly expands what Teddy had done. And that was largely, as Brinkley shows, because he grew up in this sort of lordly estate on the Hudson River. He loved trees and wildlife because he grew up with them. He called himself, when people asked him what he did, he called himself a planter of trees. And he planted about 500,000 trees on his own property. But that was
pikers compared with what the Civilian Conservation Corps did. They planted an estimated 3.5 billion trees. That's a lot of carbon sequestration. And so what Brinkley shows is that the largely because of the availability of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the national parks were enormously expanded at that time, as were the state parks. In the Bay Area, we got the regional parks, which also is an expression of the presence of the CCC at that time. So our public lands were enormously improved. And what really surprised me about that is that he also largely set up the our system of wildlife refuges, because he knew he knew exactly what was needed to save endangered species at that time, like Canada geese, pronghorn antelope, trumpeter swans. He had an amazing range of interests and knowledge about what was needed, even more so than some of the professionals at that time. And so we have Franklin Roosevelt to thank for Canada geese now being sort of a pest because there are so many of them at this point.
A lot of geese, there are a lot of manure.
Absolutely.
Lake Merritt. It's a minefield.
Well, you can blame Franklin Roosevelt on that.
I will.
Okay. But yeah, one of the things that I've been trying to get people to pay attention to is that one of his first ideas was to cut a fire break through the foothills of the Sierra Nevada to prevent fires from the lower elevations getting into the timber in the mid-elevations. It's called the Ponderosa Way. It was one of the largest CCC projects, 700-mile-long fire break through the foothills. It went right through paradise. So even though it might not have stopped the campfire dead in its tracks, because that was a wind-driven fire, it would have probably provided another evacuation route for people to get out, but it wasn't maintained like so much of the New Deal infrastructure. It wasn't maintained, and so it's pretty much ceased to exist, and most people don't even know that it ever happened.
Interesting. Yeah.
And then he had shelter belts planted to anchor the soil in the Dust Bowl. He had lakes created. There's so much that we take for granted, which is a legacy of the New Deal 80 years ago and of these men. We have accounts of CCC vets going back to the national parks to show their families the kind of beautiful stone walls that they created. They run their hands along them, and they said, "I made this," you know. And, you know, they get very emotional about it. Huh. Because Dick said, it was something that you could be proud of doing, that you were giving something back to the community. And that's what's missing today. And largely, I think that is that causes much of the cynicism that people feel towards government.
Interesting.
Yeah, they not only did tree planting, but in rural areas, tree planting, soil conservation, I think Roosevelt created 17 new national monuments, many parks. They improved all the parks that existed at the time. But in the urban areas, clean water supply, something we need again. I mean, most of the cities that had clean water in the post-war era was because of massive development of clean water supplies in the New Deal. Sewers. As well, of course, to keep the water clean, city tree planting by the WPA, city parks. So this green kind of greenness of the old New Deal was across the board from cities to the most far distant rural areas.
And one other thing, too, an anecdote that Brinkley tells is that in 1943, when Roosevelt was flying to Tehran to meet with Stalin and Churchill in the midst of the war, the plane had to fly low because it was very dangerous to do so. And he flew over the Middle East and he looked down and he understood that the desert was largely man-created, but centuries of misuse, of grazing, etc. And he determined that if he could form the United Nations, a powerful component of it would be conservation, and that land would be replanted afterwards. That would be the most effective means of ensuring peace later on, because it would get the streams flowing again. It would bring prosperity to the Middle East. We never hear that anymore.
Right.
That was part of his vision.
I feel I would be remiss not to really zero in on what exactly was the New Deal and all the things that it did. I mean, I feel like we're talking about certain particular things, but if you have to define for someone so that they really know what the New Deal was, how would you do it? What would you say?
Oh, well, that is a good question because it was...
Go to our website.
Yeah, if you go to the livingnewdeal.org on our website, one of the things we did right early on was go through and say, well, what were the New Deal programs? Because a lot of people, they've heard of the WPA, the CCC, and Social Security, and that's about it. And we came up with at least 60 programs. So it was pretty much attacking... problems of the country across the board. So there's a set of banking and financial elements. There's public works, the construction of public works, and public service employment. That's a whole nother field. There were public health and education, building schools and colleges and so on. There was conservation and parks and... you'll have to help me here, Gray. There's a few others that are really essential here. There's farm, agricultural policies, agricultural stabilization, aiding farmers, aiding tenant farmers, rebuilding the resettlement administration, rebuilt housing for farmers. There was a whole series of housing programs.
There were whole new towns.
For private housing, mortgages, then public housing, and then even more utopian ideas of whole new towns, the greenbelt towns and so on. So,
and then also regional planning, such as the TVA, for example, the Tennessee Valley Authority, planning around entire watersheds rather than the cockamamie system of states that we have.
Yeah, so it's hard to just say that New Deal was this. And the New Deal is marked by its wide range of programs attacking pretty much every kind of problem that could be identified at the time. Now, our problems today are somewhat different, somewhat overlap those of that time about jobs, labor rights, soil conservation, and trees. And some of them are very different. But still, I think the principle we come back to is you need a broad front of programs. You need a wide-ranging idea that is about national reconstruction, national revival, and kind of a national mission that makes people feel that they're participating in something bigger than themselves.
And a kind of moral rearmament, I guess. You know, I heard you the other day interviewing Robert Reich. He's talking exactly about this, too, and he's a friend of ours. He's on our board. And so he sees the larger role of a kind of how do you get back to a moral center, which we've almost entirely abandoned at this point. And that's what the New Deal was largely about.
Gray Brecken and Richard Walker are our guests. They are both with the New Living Deal program that's hosted by the UC Berkeley Department of Geography. And we are in conversation about the history of the New Deal, as well as what we can learn about the New Deal when talking about this Green New Deal that we're going to dive into in a moment. But give me a second again. Got to do some housekeeping here. We are in our winter 2019 fund drive. And I just want to let folks know that so far this hour, we have raised $520. So we are a sixth of the way to our $3,000 goal, and we have 20 minutes remaining in this hour. So, gentlemen, don't worry. It's this as usual, $500 about this time with 20 minutes to go. We like to have a big finish at the end, so this is normal. But again, it's your support that allows us to have conversations like this one, and we're doing this live. Usually I'm in here by myself doing it. But if we can keep these phone calls coming in, that will be less time that I'll have to spend asking you for a financial contribution and more time that we can dive into these very important issues. So again, a contribution of what you can afford, what's reasonable for you, one that you think we are deserving of. For listeners listening to KPFA in Northern California, that phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. For listeners in Southern California on KPFK, that phone number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. and online at kpfk.org. If you're interested in a thank you gift, we have a couple of them. One, the brand new Letters in Politics History Pack. It's the New Deal in Historic Strike Collection. Includes our conversation we had yesterday with Richard Wolff on socialism in America, our conversation today with Richard Walker and Gray Brecken, Eric Rauschwe and the New Deal in Fascism. We actually talked about that a few weeks ago. That's a part of this. Our conversation with Robert Reich when we were talking more about how do you finance a Green New Deal? How was the New Deal financed? And then some other really interesting shows I think we did with Jack Kelly on the Pullman strike and the rise of Eugene Victor Debs in 1894. Our conversation with Jesse Norman on Adam Smith. I actually enjoyed that conversation a lot. David Reeve on Aristotle's politics and a whole lot more, including Alan Hirsch and the impeachment of Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton and the history behind that. So that's yours for a pledge of $100. We're also offering, I thought, a very accessible and fine book about the history of the New Deal called The New Deal by Michael Hiltzik. That's available for $100. You can get either of those for a pledge of $100 or both together at the discounted rate of $175. And finally, we have a challenge of $500 from James in Clear Lake and Gertrude in Mill Valley to raise $500 in the next 10 minutes. If we could do it, my friends, that would be $1,000 towards our overall goal, and that would be a very big deal for us and help us make this a success so that we can have these programs during Fun Drive. So I hope that we can bring you something worth tuning into during the drive rather than scaring you away. So the phone number, if you're listening to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org, and in Southern California, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, or online at kpfk.org. Challenge begins now.
Hey, gentlemen. Mitch,
yes, sir.
Can I pledge $50 on air?
Sure, you sure can.
Since we have a
I'll match that.
We'll have to get you a card to fill out.
Okay.
But thank you, sir. And Gray said he'd match that. So that's even $100. So now we're at $600. Now we're at $740 altogether.
Guys.
So thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Very kind. Thank you. Thank you. I also want to thank Sheila in Berkeley for her contribution as well. And my good friend, her name's not here this time, so I'm not going to say it, but my good friend in Lambertville, New Jersey. Okay. Green New Deal.
Right.
How do you see what do you think is really important to know about the New Deal? And maybe we've kind of already touched upon it, but just to zero in on it, what's important to know about the New Deal in order to have a framework for the Green New Deal?
Well, I'll say two things. One is that we've, on our website, livingnewdeal.org, we now have a new Green New Deal page to feature links to debates and so on. But we have on there 10 principles derived from the New Deal that should be applied to any program, Green New Deal equivalent today. So I encourage people to go look at that. And I think one thing we haven't talked about enough is universal programs. It's very important to make your programs universal. And I think so far the Green New Deal resolution by AOC and Markey has done that. And I think that's absolutely what needs to be done. One of the failings of a lot of liberal policies is, well, we're targeting this group or that group or whatever. It has to really be about all Americans, about all working people. You have to have a sense of the vast majority of people are involved in this, are going to benefit it, can see something tangible coming out of it. So universal programs. And I would add, when we talk about conservation programs and green programs like the CCC, what was very important about the New Deal is it didn't concentrate on the cities, which have been, of course, for 500 years, have been slowly eroding the countryside, winning the battle for who's going to dominate the economy. And it's gotten worse today. But they also targeted the out-of-way places, the declining places, the rural places that have been backwaters, you know, Appalachia and the rural West, and the people, Native American reservations, the Southwest and agricultural areas there. They targeted all these areas. I mean, targeted. They swept them up in programs like the CCC, like farm aid and so on, like rural electrification. that provided for a huge boost to the places that were suffering the most. And, of course, this can be applied, this principle should be applied to those parts of big cities that are suffering, the communities that are not doing well, which we have plenty of. But that sense that it's everywhere. And if you go, if you drive around America and you go to county seats everywhere and go to rural areas everywhere, you find parks, airports, a new city hall, schools. It's sewage plants in the most obscure places. And it's often the New Deal building or the New Deal park is one of the three best buildings or public services in the whole community because not much has happened since. And we have to have that sense that we're helping everybody because that's where a lot of the support for right-wing policies for Trump come from is those kind of places. And we have to make them feel included in an overall universal program of recovery.
I think that's a really good point because one of the things that Roosevelt talked about that we really haven't heard about since perhaps Lyndon Johnson is poverty, the spreading epidemic of poverty in this country. People think we're not living in a depression now. Millions of people are living in the Great Depression. The homeless encampments now are much more squalid than the Hoovervilles during the Great Depression.
That's interesting. What we've seen over these last few years, these erections of these homeless camps.
Well, you just see it everywhere now.
It's like our own version of shantytown.
Absolutely, but they're much worse than they were at that time. I mean, unbelievable squalor, which is a public health menace to everybody. And I take the train a lot. I like trains, so I ride Amtrak. And I'm seeing more and more homeless encampments along the railway right-of-ways, which is, you know, the last place that people can go to in industrial zones. So Roosevelt talked about poverty. And one of the problems we have now is we haven't heard that from the Democrats, from Clinton, Hillary, and Bill, or Obama. They didn't talk about it, which is one of the reasons we have President Trump. He was saying that everything's going to be great, but we need to talk about poverty and all the pathologies that come out of it. Roosevelt talked about that as a Christian obligation to help those less fortunate. So when he proposed the Civilian Conservation Corps, he said that it would solve two problems at the same time. It would redeem wasted land and wasted people. It would put young men to work in beautiful, healthy environments and give them great food and everything. And it worked. It put millions of young men back to work and gave them a vocation and a meaning. And we need something like that today. That would be part of the Green New Deal, obviously, because it is the, as I said, the moral equivalent of war. We also have to reevaluate the money that we spend on war and the preparation for war. That's one of the reasons people hate taxes so much, because they're unlike the New Deal, they're not seeing their taxes coming back to their communities in new schools, roads, swimming pools, golf courses, etc., as people did during the 1930s. A completely different attitude.
Let me just give a quick update on that challenge. Again, this fundraising we have to do. We have about a minute and a half left in this $500 challenge. And at this point, we are $150 away. It's an opportunity for you to double your donation to your radio station right now. If we can make it, if we cannot, we'll have to offer James and Gertrude their money back. If you're listening in San Francisco, Northern California, Bay Area, phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. Now, 1 minute remaining in this challenge period. Help us double this money with your contribution today. I feel like we always have to mention this because I don't want to gloss over it, but I think of the work of Ira Katznelson, somebody who's done a tremendous amount of work on the New Deal, and how Jim Crow policies were a part of the New Deal.
Something that's been raised a lot lately, but often by people who don't really understand the New Deal or the history. You know, they don't have a sense of history. The New Deal did not bring about the Civil Rights Revolution. That happened a generation later. It did, however, in many ways lay the foundation for it. So there's also Thomas Sugrue's book about liberty, you know, Sweet Land of Liberty, which talks about the northern roots, the interwar roots of the civil rights movement. And a lot of that got a push from the New Deal. The New Deal, the New Dealers were almost universally anti-racist. And they did what they could to target African Americans. Native American laws changed dramatically under the New Deal. Asian Americans and Latinos were hired in large numbers in these WPA, CCC, CWA.
So it didn't exclude non-whites, but it segregated them. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, in certain programs, because it was very much based on a federalist agreement between local and national government, that the local governments would choose projects, would choose the people to do them, to design them, and so on. And so the local governments almost universally demanded segregated camps and WPA and CCC in the long run. But it didn't start that way. CCC did not start segregated.
Outside
of the South, mm-hmm. That's right. And WPA was never segregated, actually. I don't think it was.
No, we have amazing photographs of the WPA workers sitting down, and it's quite racially mixed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you built public housing, generally the local communities would not allow it unless it was segregated. But we forget when we say that the New Deal intentionally built housing for African Americans, for Native Americans. So they knew that these people needed housing, and they provided, and jobs. And they were hired at the same wage in the WPA or the CCC. There was no discrimination there. So, listen, it didn't overturn America's white supremacy and a segregated society by any means. But it did make some important steps. It did involve people of color and help them, aid them, as it was aiding everyone. And I think that that's still a principle that we need as we get rid of segregation.
And if you go to the Living New Deal website, we actually have pages on inclusion of Asian Americans, women, disabled, seniors. It's amazing the efforts that they did at the time that they did it.
Give me that website. Now people are going to want to see it. Maybe you could just Google it, the Living New Deal.
Well, it's livingnewdeal.org.
Uh-huh.
That's very simple. And on it, there's a portion called What Was the New Deal? And under that, there's programs and so on. And there's a discussion of inclusion, New Deal inclusion. And there's pages on 10 different groups, the disabled, the elderly, women, African Americans, Native Americans, and so on.
Yeah.
And it turns out they did an enormous amount for every one of these groups. For example, some of the first disabled programs in America were the New Deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's amazing. I mean, again, just to think about it, and I regret to say we're actually out of time, but to really think about the significance of what the New Deal did of providing safety nets for people that didn't exist before.
These weren't
part of it. We take them for granted today. Social Security, Medicare didn't come from the New Deal, but in the spirit of the New Deal in the 1960s, these things didn't exist before. And people, when they were older, were just out of luck. If they got hurt, became disabled on the job, they were just out of luck. Or you had to have your family take care of you. So really significant stuff that came out of here. I think it's important to remember.
Yeah, the basic idea of the New Deal was it cared about the mass of American people.
Yeah.
I always say that the Roosevelts were practicing rather than professing Christians.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mitch.
I have to try to make my goal now, and I hope folks will appreciate the conversation. But I know I appreciated the conversation, and people are pledging, so some out there have appreciated.
We've done our job.
As well. So thank you both. Richard Walker, Gray Brecken, thank you.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you.
My friends, we did make that $500 challenge. We are now at $1,400 for the hour, but we're not quite at our goal of $3,000, and that's not an arbitrary number. That's a number that I need to be able to raise to be able to bring shows like this one during the fund drive. If we can have a big turnout here in our final 4 minutes, my friends, I think we can make it. If you're listening in the San Francisco Bay Area, the phone number is 1-800-439-4444. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, that phone number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Online at kpfk.org. And if you're thinking $1,600 is not possible to raise at this moment, let me tell you that we have another challenge that came in from Jose in Oakland, James in San Francisco, and another James in Half Moon Bay that are putting up $800 right now. If we could raise that now, it's just 3.5 minutes to go, though, my friends. If we could raise that $800 in the next 3.5 minutes, we have enough phone room volunteers to do it, though. We could use more if you want to come in to KPFA today. Help us out. We can make this if you go to your phones right now. Again, if you're listening to KPFA in Northern California or on kpfa.org, you can actually pledge at kpfa.org. It's fast, secure, and easy. Or you could talk to our phone room folks by giving us a call, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, that phone number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, or online at kpfk.org. We now have just under 3 minutes to make that $800 challenge. We are so far $200 towards it. My guests, they're still here in the studio. They're getting excited. They're on the edge of their seats. Welcome to my world, gentlemen.
Mitch Jeserich does one of the greatest shows on public radio, period. And I'll pitch in another 50.
Okay. So we are now $550 away from making that challenge.
Go.
Do I hear a 75? Again, the number 8 4. KPFA in Northern California, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, it's 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, online at kpfk.org. $250 towards that $800 challenge, my friends. That's five people pledging $100 each. That's one person, perhaps, pledging $500 if your means allow you to do that. If you can do that without actually looking into your bank account to see if it's possible. If you have to look into your bank account to see if that's possible, we're actually going to ask you not to do it because that seems a little bit unreasonable. We don't want you to break the bank. We don't want you not to be able to make ends meet at the end of the month. We want what you could do, what's appropriate for you, what you feel good about, knowing that you did your part for this tradition of public broadcasting. Again, for KPFA listeners, to our final 90 seconds, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Kevin Anderson, a rule book for the climate casino. Even though climate scientist Kevin Anderson has given up flying, he attended via train and ferry most of the annual COPs, the conferences of the parties. They're held under the auspices of the United Nations Framework on Climate Change. And as Deputy Director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research in the UK, he contributes to the science. Kevin Anderson says that we have known since 1990 about the need to end fossil fuel use. However, now, 28 years later, emissions of greenhouse gases are still going up and are a staggering 65% higher than in 1990. Kevin Anderson is very clear about the reasons why the industrial and political powers in the world are preventing the phase-out of fossil fuel use. And he calls out some of them in this panel discussion. But he also presents a statistic that he finds empowering. The economist Piketty in Carbon and Inequality found that only 10% of world population are responsible for 30% of CO2 emissions. That, of course, includes the now infamous 1% with their personal jets, fleets of gas-guzzling cars, and multiple McMansions. But it also includes people like us. You will hear in a moment a panelist ask Anderson if academics are part of the 10%. And yes, on a world scale, compared with people who barely have enough water and food, this gives many of us personal responsibility and agency and opportunity. Kevin Anderson also points to the economics of growth that are preventing the phase-out of fossil fuels and can even destroy efforts such as green development initiatives as long as they also promise growth. Plus, amazingly, in such a short presentation, Anderson and the panelists have scathing criticism of the techno-fixes that protect the current economic system and delay action. They promise that as yet unproven technologies will suck the CO2 back out of the atmosphere. You will hear Anderson's take on BECCS, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. The conversation with Kevin Anderson was recorded at the 2018 COP in Poland. He was the guest on a panel organized by the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. Here's Kevin Anderson.
We are 28 years now on since the first report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The emissions are probably about 65% higher and are still going up. And we still meet in these events like this, and we still say the same things we've been saying for pretty much 28 years.
Well, thank you all for coming to the another Scientists Warning TV program here from COP24 in Katowice, Poland. The hosts today, Victoria Hirth, who's an associate professor of sustainable business at the University of Plymouth. And my name's Stuart Scott. I'm the executive director of ScientistsWarning.org and a member of Survival University. And our guests today, very pleased to have with us, Professor Kevin Anderson, who's deputy director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research. And he is associated with the faculties of the universities of Manchester and Uppsala in Sweden. And with him, Dr. Hugh Hunt at the Department of Engineering at Cambridge University. Today's program, a rule book for the climate casino.
Imagine that we actually thought climate change was a real existential threat, a real serious issue. And so we put in regulations at a global level so that the top 10% of global emitters had to reduce their carbon footprint to the level of the average European person. So just the top 10% of high emitters down to the level of the average European. And the other 90% of the world's population made no reduction in their current level of emissions.
Okay, so when you say the top 10%, are we in that top 10%?
We probably are. We're probably definitely in the top 20%. We may well be in the top 10, depending exactly what we do. But yes, people like us.
So the top 10%, we're talking about people who have high consumption lifestyles. They fly a lot, they travel a lot, they have perhaps more than two homes. More than one home.
Yeah, but certainly more than one home, yes.
Well, I was just going to say, the figures about 10 years ago, that if you had about £53,000 worth of assets, you were in the top 10%.
Okay.
As a ballpark.
Yeah.
So the question then is, if these people were to reduce their emissions to the European average.
Yeah, the European average. Yeah, a lot of the people in Europe, I think the average person in Europe is a reasonable, comfortable person.
And so what you're saying is the figure that you've got on that slide is that if that happened, then that's one-third off global emissions.
Yeah, one-third. And I think what's important there is that if you look at the Paris Agreement, all the pledges that were made by all the countries around the world, that's for virtually no reduction by 2030. So what I'm simply saying here is this isn't going to solve climate change. But if we thought it was a really serious issue, just 10% reducing to the level of the average European is a one-third cut in global emissions. Now, as I say, we have to do a lot more than that, but that would be a very good start.
Well, so the idea that we kind of know who these high emitters are. They're wealthy people?
Well, we wouldn't call them wealthy because they're our friends and our family, probably. The communities we work within, that most of those people are probably relatively wealthy. But it's not, I mean, it's not just about them. The whole mindset that has driven, for at least the last 30 or 40 years, how virtually all governments now think about these issues, this sort of Davos mentality. You can call it the socioeconomic model or the neoliberal model, but basically this one of ongoing growth with very high levels of inequality at a global level, but even within countries, very high levels of inequality. That's the norm that, we've got now that we daren't question. So almost that's a given.
It's a given because we've got our pensions are hooked up in economic growth, the future. We just assume that the things that we own now will be more valuable in 10 years' time. I mean, yeah. It's kind of the norm. But how does that link into climate change?
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear linked between economic growth and our carbon emissions. We've gone from this sort of Davos world where you've got these incredibly wealthy people turning up once a year at Davos and discussing world problems like hunger and poverty with no understanding of the irony of that, really, that these are the people that in many respects are causing the problems because of their completely profligate level of consumption, and that they've set a model that the rest of us are all aspiring to. We'll probably never get there, but we're all aspiring to that. And what I would argue is that hasn't the COP and the way we're dealing with climate change sort of become part of that? That what we have is this, I call them climate glitterati, that claim to be concerned about climate change, and it can always be solved by some technology in the future. So there's no problem with them and how they live their lives, but they like that idea of rubbing shoulders with the people from Davos. There's this whole sort of prestige that is passed down from this group of elites, this climate glitterati group, and that, if you like, cascades down through the whole system. So we're all now developing solutions that don't question the current economic model. We can't question that.
So the recent IPCC 1.5 degree report is full of lots of technologies, negative emissions technologies, BECCS, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. That the models seem to be that we're not going to change our habits much, so we're going to need technologies to achieve the Paris Agreement. Now, the problem surely with these technologies is that they don't exist yet. The climate casino is we're gambling on there being technical solutions to do these negative emissions. And if not, then what happens?
Well, there's two gambles. We're gambling, firstly, that they will work, and they will work at huge planetary scale. And just give some feeling of that, you're talking about hundreds of billions, even up to maybe a trillion tons of carbon dioxide sucked out of the atmosphere by these technologies that we do not have at the moment. But on top of that, because we know they're going to happen later in the century when people like you and I are retired, and that we hope that in the interim that the feedbacks in the climate system will not make the situation much worse. So rather than reduce our emissions today very significantly, we're going to hope, we're going to gamble that feedbacks aren't going to be very great and that we're then going to have these technologies in years to come.
Well, so you were saying earlier that if the top 10% of emitters were to reduce their emissions to the average European level.
Yeah. Not voluntarily, I don't think.
Well, yeah, okay, we'll have to give them a little bit of a nudge. But that would be one third of our emissions. So that's about 10 billion tonnes of CO2 every year.
A bit more than that, but yes, yeah.
So thereabouts. So that's in 10 years, that's 100 billion tonnes. I mean, That's a trillion tons for the century, in a century.
I mean, yes.
So we can solve the problem.
Before you go on, you were talking about negative emissions technologies. Yeah. They exist or they don't yet exist?
Well, they do, but not on a scale that we need them on. For example, one negative emissions technology is to plant lots of trees, which sucks CO2 out of the atmosphere, burn those trees in our power stations instead of burning coal, and then capture the CO2 from the chimneys and put that CO2 underground. So that's bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. Well, that's a negative emissions technology because the CO2 is coming in into your biomass, into your trees, and then it's ending up underground.
So the trees are sucking up the carbon. So it's fair to say that negative emissions technologies suck CO2?
Yes. Yeah. So they do. And the scale we're talking about, we're currently emitting of the order of, say, 40 billion tonnes of CO2 per year globally. If we're going to make an impact on that 40 billion tonnes using negative emissions technologies, We've got to create a new industry that is on that kind of scale. So 10 billion tons would be pretty good. But inventing a new industry that can handle 10 billion tons of CO2, we're not going to do that in the next 5 years, next 10 years. We'd be lucky if we did that in the next 50 years. But the time scale is so long. So,
and the system implications. I mean, people look at these things and you just think, on average, biofuel, biomass, has about one quarter the energy density of say, typical fossil fuel. And yet a huge amount of the ships travelling around the world are carrying fossil fuels. If you're going to move from fossil fuels to biomass, you're going to have a massive increase in the amount of shipping, all the ports that are going to be available, all of that infrastructure. So when we have these models, you press the button and that infrastructure exists. In reality, of course, that infrastructure takes a decade or two decades just to build.
So, I mean, at a company level, you'd look at the energy pyramid if you were trying to deal with issues of energy. And the first thing that you would do is you would consume less because it's the cheapest thing to do.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that at a global level, because consuming less doesn't fit the economic growth paradigm, we are bypassing that very clear, easy win and moving straight to investment decisions that create new industries that might or might not come about.
Yeah. I think we have to bear in mind it's not just that they're only relying on these models on negative emissions. There are plenty of other things as well. But actually it comes back to some ways the same sort of approach. A lot of people are discussing carbon taxes. Now, sometimes you can have a carbon tax that you can arrange to have the revenue go back to the population more generally, and that's less problematic. There are some benefits of that. But often people just about adding a carbon tax, and if you put the price up, then we consume less. But then you start to think, well, who's the we there? Again, we're perfectly aware that you and I are not going to consume less if you increase the price of fossil fuels, not with any reasonable margin. We're going to carry on just paying the bill. But the poorer people, the 20% of houses in the UK in fuel poverty, they'll consume slightly less. We're not going to solve climate change. So, in fact, again, is this issue, the wealthy don't want to consume less, but we do think the carbon tax will squeeze the emissions out of the poor people, but without really thinking of the math through that, because at the end of the day, the poor people aren't hardly emitting, as we're going to show in a slide in a minute.
So what's an alternative to the carbon tax that would therefore allow, would get over that issue?
Let's be blunt about climate change. We have a certain carbon budget, total amount of carbon dioxide we can spend over the century.
But that's essentially what was agreed in Paris.
That's effectively what's agreed in Paris, yeah.
And what we've had recently, this 1.5 report from the IPCC, is giving us ways of achieving this. But if we don't use the negative emissions technologies, what we've got to do is the high emitters have got to emit less, is this equity concept.
Yeah, we've got to ration it out. What we have is, if we want to meet our Paris commitments, and there are very good reasons to meet those commitments, then we have a carbon ration, a global carbon ration. And you can divide that out between countries, but also I think it's interesting how we divide that out amongst individuals, amongst high emitters. I'm not saying we should only consider it that way, but I think that's important.
So something like tradable energy quotas?
Something like that, some sort of mechanism that allows us to have a fair rationing system. So if we accept we must meet the Paris Agreement, if we accept the broad science coming from the IPCC, you are left with this difficult and uncomfortable position that you have to have some form of rationing. And then when you look at the emissions, how they're skewed, and that plays back to the little experiment at the beginning, you can see here the emissions curve. So this is for the different income groups, and you see that emissions are massively skewed to the top 10, 20, perhaps 30%. So 70% of global emissions, 70%, come from about the top 10% of global emitters. And remember, these don't just live in the wealthy parts of the world. There are plenty of people living in China and India and other countries now who are also very, very high emitters.
Apparently, the World Bank only a couple of weeks ago said it was doing away with the term developing countries because precisely of that issue, that wealth is so skewed within countries and across countries.
Yes, yeah. But clearly, the averages are still very different between countries as well. So I think it's worth bearing that in mind.
So what this figure that you mentioned before about it, reducing emissions to that of the average European, and that's somewhere around eight tons of CO2 per person per year?
Yeah, 7 to 8 tons. Okay, territorially, that's just within the boundaries of, say, Europe. If you take out of our imports and exports and everything else, it comes a bit higher.
Let's just unpick that figure of 8 tons. Somehow we think it's a real infringement on us as individuals to reduce our CO2 waste from 50 tons a year down to 8 tons a year, because somehow it's our right in some way, because we are economically driven to emit this CO2.
But I think it's interesting that our whole argument about rights there, what we mean is it's a right for those of us that can afford it to carry on doing it. But already the rights to use energy to improve the quality of life for many poor people is already taken away simply because they can't afford it. So our society is already very happy to have people who cannot afford to enough energy to live good qualities of lives. And that is including in wealthy parts of the world as well, poorer people in those countries and also elsewhere in the world. So we're happy for them to be constrained, but we're not happy for us, the wealthy ones, at the top of this curve to be constrained.
So what are the things that us wealthy people have to do to take this action?
Well, firstly, it's got to be done virtually immediately. You know, if we're doing now and the next, say, 5 years, that's the really important part. If we're going to come off the curve really fast, then you cannot do that with technologies in the first 5 years. So that's why I often make the point, the first 5 years, the thing you've got to do is drive down changes in behaviour by the very high emitters. And that, there's real scope, when you look at that, for actually driving those emissions down if we're serious about Paris. And when we talk about what does that mean, that means things like we will have to forego a lot of what we might think of as normal things, but most other people will see as luxuries. You know, those large cars, the regular flights, the business class flights, you know, having second homes, having very large homes, the very high levels of consumption, the things we've normalised, and we use the language of we're worth it. You know, we think we're worth it, other people aren't.
So I go to the supermarket and it says, special this week, 3-for-1 mangoes. And I think, oh, mangoes, they're nice. So how do those mangoes get from wherever they grow to the supermarket in England or in Poland? And we just don't think about it. Where does the coffee come from? Where do the peanuts come from? It's just taken for granted that we can just get these things.
Yeah.
We have to start thinking about these things very differently.
But also, then when we get them home, you know, we'll take those mangoes, we'll put them in our nice large car, possibly a four-wheel drive to keep the children protected when we drive them to school. We'll drive them back to our large house, open our double-door refrigerator so we can store our mangoes in there. At every single level, we've normalised very, very high levels of consumption. And so we're going to have to change that very rapidly indeed. So the argument I often make is if we are serious about climate change, which does, of course, require lots of technologies, then we've got to make this transfer of the labour and the resources that at the moment furnish the relative luxuries of the people at the top of this curve, people like us. The labour and the resources that are furnishing that part of our life are going to be required for making this massive shift to a decarbonised energy infrastructure.
But it's people like us who are making the decisions.
That is the biggest problem, I think. And that's why, to me, having people who are not that wealthy, having their voices heard is really important. And here, probably the most potent voice in the whole of COP24 has been that of a 15-year-old girl, has been Greta, who's raising these very difficult questions to people like us and to her own parents. So there are plenty of people out there who can voice that concern, and we need to make they need to grab that power, make that space to be heard.
So do we maybe need to adhere to one of the major rules of good governance, which is removing conflicts of interest?
Well,
from the process.
Yeah, that'd certainly be very good if we could move conflicts of interest. Well, they're often quite hidden as well.
One thing I don't hear is climate scientists coming out and saying what they really think. Because presumably, surely, the modellers, the people who are doing the underlying climate modelling, are absolutely 100% aware of the things that we're saying. But we don't hear them say it.
Well, I hear them say it quite often.
But in places like this?
No. If you put a microphone in front of someone or ask them to write something on a piece of paper or type something on their computer to go into the public domain, no, they won't say this. Right. They'll say something that nicely fits with the Davos model. But actually away from that, and we'll also, though we don't rely on these things, we do quite convenient, I think, massage our assumptions to provide nice outputs. But actually privately, you often often hear people saying, no, this is, we're just going to hell in a handcart. That's the language I would use. They're using their forms of phraseology. But yeah, that's very commonly the case when you move the microphones away, when you're chatting over a coffee or a beer.
It's interesting. I was at an adaptation meeting a few months ago where the figure for sea level rise that was kind of accepted in the adaptation circles is 0.4 metres by the end of the century. But as soon as you go and have a beer in the pub afterwards, they're privately saying, 1 metre, 1.5 metres, because that's the figure that they've done the models themselves. They know what's coming. But what has to be reported is models that they can say that there's confidence in these models.
Now, that was something that James Hansen and I brought up at the last COP. Jim calls it scientific reticence, and it's a big problem that scientists won't say publicly what they will say privately.
But if you then start saying in the models that at the moment the models don't include feedbacks like Arctic ice, summer ice disappearing, there'll be less albedo, less reflection of sunlight from the Arctic, so the Arctic we'll warm up, we'll get perhaps release of methane from the permafrost. None of these feedbacks are in the models because, we don't understand them well enough to put them in the models?
Some are in the models, and as we get better understanding, they gradually get into the models. But I think it's really worth bearing in mind that, lots of great science is going on in these areas, but there's lots of uncertainty. So to me, what we often require is, you know, science is innately conservative, and the actual pure science models I'm very happy with. But what they need to go along with are very clear paragraphs or sets of assumptions. You know, we have not included this for these reasons. These aren't included, and what might happen if these things end up being as bad as we think?
But it doesn't happen like that, because you get these reports, like that IPCC 1.5 report. Where does it mention the permafrost? And it's not as if the people reading it, it's not as if the journalists reading it are going to say, oh, by the way, this report doesn't include some important feedback. That never gets said.
No, it doesn't get. And actually, I think there is a role there for journalism, because actually the reports themselves, even if you look at some for policymakers, in the sort of the greyer text rather than the bold text, it does say these things. So I think there's an honesty there, but it's the role in the journalist to pick them out, particularly in the really good journalists who are trying to inform the public, to put them there. But overall, I think the science is doing a good job, but these other caveats are really important and need to be emphasised much more than they are.
And including, there was a Nature article that we brought up the other day as well, including the caveat of the policy environment, the feedback loops of it's relying on a stable policy environment. We have to take a more conservative view of what actually is going to be implemented. Yeah. And as well as the emissions gap report, which came out the other day.
Yeah.
So we're talking about Paris here, but when you look at what's actually been committed there in terms of NDCs, it's way off where we need to be.
NDCs, please define your terms.
Sorry, national determined contributions.
Those are the voluntary targets that nations can then lie about.
Yeah. It's also worth bearing in mind that we had the Global Carbon Project just report this year that the emissions in 2018 look they're going to be up something around about 2.7% growth. It was 1.6 last year, 2.7 this year. So we're going completely the wrong direction. So we're not even heading towards the NDCs, these pledges, these promises that are made. I do think we need to sort of almost stop and reflect that we are 28 years now on since the first report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The emissions are probably at 65% higher and are still going up. And we still meet in these events like this, and we still say the same things we've been saying for pretty much 28 years.
And the simple things that we can do are to be done by the richest 10%. Because if we're looking at this chart here again, are we going, not much point in asking the people that don't consume very much at all to consume less.
Yeah, I mean, that's always my point. This plot is a really good example. It comes from the work originally by Lucas Chancellor and Thomas Piketty in 2015 on carbon inequality, and then the infographic was done later. But basically, if you look at that, you can't squeeze carbon emissions out of people who hardly emit. And that's a sort of such a fundamental thing you get when you look at the data. But we're not, even in COP, we're not prepared to accept that.
I actually did my PhD on this very topic back in 2002. And when I spoke to someone from what's then DEFRA about why in the UK we're not focusing, I also studied in South Africa where the inequalities are really stark, why are we not focusing the efforts on the areas where we can make the most difference? It's just logical. And I was told that it's not politically viable.
No.
Well, so we often talk about, people should fly less. And then the retort is, flying only represents 2%, let's say, of global CO2 emissions. But isn't it right to say that the type of people who are flying lots are also the same people who've got high consumption lifestyles? So by picking out the people who fly a lot, are we also picking out the people who have other aspects of their lifestyles that are high emission?
Well, I think it's flying is emblematic. Of course, not everyone who flies will be very high emitters. Most of them will be. There'll be other people who occasionally fly for whatever reason who won't be. But it's emblematic of a very high carbon lifestyle. People who are the frequent flyers particularly, you know, academics amongst them, you know, we will live in typically larger houses than the average person. We'll drive a bigger car, we'll drive further, we'll consume more goods. You know, we go to a lot more conferences, we'll probably have more holidays away, we'll have weekend breaks somewhere. So almost every facet of our life is going to be much higher consumption.
So
the flying is, though, important as well. I mean, we have to bear in mind that everyone always says everything's only over 2%. UK is 2%, California's 2%, flying is 2%, shipping is 2%, 50 times 2 is 100. 2% is important.
Yeah.
And actually, it's a particular industry here where there are no alternatives in the near to medium term, to move away from it being locked into a high-carbon infrastructure, and it's growing very rapidly. But it's not the only issue. There are many other issues to address.
We have a final quote.
It's a quote that came out of a Twitter discussion with Alex Steffen, who always makes really interesting comments. And he said, and I think it really captures where we are, winning slowly is basically the same thing as losing outright. In the face of both triumphant denialism, and we see that with the US, with Russia, with Qatar, with Saudi.
With Poland.
With Poland. And predatory delay. But we see that everywhere, whether that's Denmark, France, the UK, or Sweden, the progressive countries, whether it's the people intending us people attending COP. We see the predatory delay everywhere. Anything we can do to avoid making the changes today and passing the buck to the next generation. So we're all party to that. But then he goes on to say, to achieve climate action by doing the same things, the same old ways, means defeat. It guarantees defeat. And we've been doing the same things at COPs and discussing the same issues within our governments for 28 years, and the emissions are 65% higher. At some point, we have to wake up and smell the coffee. You know, we are failing abysmally, and we have to start to rethink this differently.
So if we should be flying less, why are we thinking about building a third runway at Heathrow Airport? We're doing the same thing all the time.
We're all, as you said by the dice here, we're all gambling. We were gambling on so many levels. We're gambling on technology in the future. We're gambling on the feedbacks. We're gambling on electric planes and all these other things that are there. So,
now, I'm going to have to end our brilliant discussion here. This has been another Scientist's Warning program. I'm your host, Stuart Scott, my co-host, Victoria Hirth. And we've been coming to you live from the UN Climate Negotiations COP24 in Katowice, Poland. Thank you for joining us.
The goal of the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative is to bring scientists and religious leaders together to mobilize action, not just talk, for justice and ecological sustainability. This program was produced off the electric grid with solar power in the mountains of Northern California. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gleiden. Thank you for listening.
Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The transcendent experience of street basketball is the topic of two conversations with Onaje Woodbine, the author of Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip-Hop, and Street Basketball. Woodbine grew up in the inner city of Roxbury, Massachusetts, became a skilled basketball player, and attended Yale University on a basketball scholarship. After 2 years as a star player on the Yale team, he chose a different life path and quit the basketball team. After graduating from Yale, Woodbine earned his Ph.D. in religious studies from Boston University. His book, Black Gods of the Asphalt, presents a social anthropological view of this inner city sport where the coaches often assume the role of father, mentor, and friend. Woodbine contrasts the lessons he learned on the street basketball courts of Roxbury with those he learned at the predominantly white basketball courts and locker rooms of Yale University. Onaje Woodbine visited with Radio Curious by phone on August 13, 2016, from his home in Andover, Massachusetts, and began by describing his relationship with his father, Dr. Robert Woodbine.
My father and I really became close when I was 15 years old. from about the age of 7 to 15, he wasn't really in my life. And during that time, I had lost loved ones. I had what I would call depression, a lot of fear because I lived in between several gangs. And, you know, I had sort of lost my connection with the world in a sense. I withdrew from the world. And when my father entered my life at 15, he helped me navigate that inner terrain. He showed me that I had a purpose. He gave me some language for what I was experiencing. He showed me how to meditate and to trust that still small voice within. And, you know, that gave me something that the streets, that the violence of the inner city, that the ghetto couldn't touch. You know, and I realized at that point that I was a human being, you know, and I had something nobody could take away. So I took that to the basketball court. You know, it had been there for me. That was really the only place I could feel safe in the inner city. And now I had language. Now I had practices. I could practice my breathing on the court when everything around me was chaotic. So that relationship really planted the seed for what would become, you know, this project, Black Gods of the Asphalt.
So how would you characterize your relationship with your father in comparison to your peers' relationships with their fathers?
Most of my friends did not know their fathers. Our coaches were our fathers. You know, my coach, Manny Wilson, you know, I felt like he helped raise me. He was there for me when I needed him. He gave me an image of what a man should be. He loved me, you know, and I think most of my friends, the young men in the neighborhood, felt that way about Coach Manny. But he passed away when I was 12 years old, and that sent me into a sort of spiral of depression, along with other things that were happening in the city. But I was lucky to reconnect with my father. I think most of my peers have never had that opportunity. And I think they feel an anger towards their father or the absence of their father. I think they carry around that injury with them like I did, you know, until I was able to reconnect with my father. And it truly changed my life. I think if I hadn't had that experience, I think I would have had some sort of mental, emotional, serious issues. I think I certainly wouldn't be where I am now.
You talk about the search for male role models on the local basketball court. Your male role model is unique to you and your father, different from your peers. It's the coaches who become the role model?
Yes. You know, you spend the most time, you know, with any male in the neighborhood. You spend time with your coach the most. I mean, outside of that, you know, many of the schools in inner city Boston, you know, are not really staffed by you know, black men. And at home, you often find that, you know, black men are missing. And so one of the few places that young black men have to experience guidance and support and encouragement from older black men is in the gym or, you know, on the street basketball court. You know, you also have it in the church, but, you know, a lot of these young men who are in the streets don't feel like the church is relevant. You know, they find that, You know, there's a generational gap and a gap in understanding, you know, about what is being talked about on Sunday and what is actually happening in their lives on a day-to-day basis. And so the basketball court becomes this place where young men can dialogue and express what's happening in the streets with other men, and particularly older men. So it really is so almost fitted perfectly for this kind of rite of passage between, you know, boys having an opportunity to become men in the inner city.
Can you describe that fit for us?
So when you think about a street basketball court, it's open. The doors are always open. It's free. It's right there. It's accessible, right? It's right there in the inner city. You don't need money to enter there. No doors, right? It's not an institution. And the young men crowd around the space along with older men. It's where everybody goes to converse, to talk about their stories, to share what happened during their day. So the other fit here too is that it, you know, for young men who find it hard to express their emotions in the street, because in the street you have to be tough, you have to, you know, wear this mask of masculinity. But in sports you can cry, you can express emotion. You know, you can be vulnerable. So not only is it accessible, but it's acceptable for young men, African-American men, to express their feelings in this space. And it's one of the few places you can do that in such a tough environment. So for a number of reasons, it's almost like a perfect fit for this kind of work.
What is it that allows the perfect fit beyond the openness and the camaraderie on the basketball team? And you characterize that in your book, Black Gods of the Asphalt, as being different from being a member of a gang.
So what is really important that differentiates basketball from membership in the gang is this idea, or there's really this experience that involves the body, the movement of the body. In basketball, you have to let go of distraction. You have to put sort of your thoughts aside and enter your body and really experience. And I think that's so important, you know, to why the game allows these young men and gives them an escape from, you know, the everyday violence of the streets. You know, when you join a gang, you have to wear a mask. You can't show emotion or you'll become a target, you know. But in order to really play basketball well, you can't pretend, right? You have to be authentic. Right? You have to let go and truly allow yourself the freedom and the vulnerability to enter into the space and experience and express yourself. And so I think just like all art sort of allows or promotes or encourages that process, basketball does that for young men in the inner city.
There's a difference here that I'm hearing what you're saying and what I experienced in reading your book about the mask that is put on within the gang relationship of its own members and compared to other members, which when you have skill, as you do and did as a basketball player, allows you a free pass among the territories of the gangs. Can you talk
about that? That's very true.
Can you talk about that difference?
Yeah, so a lot of that has to do, I think, with the overall idea within the inner city that basketball players have hope, you know, or represent hope. You know, a lot of guys in the inner city believe that if you're a basketball player, you have a chance to live a life without violence. That, you know, many of the gang members just assume that they're going to have a foreshortened future, right? That they're going to die young. But I think because the larger culture sort of encourages black men to play basketball and sort of mirrors back to them that it's possible for them to gain access to opportunities outside of the inner city if they play basketball. And I think even the gang members feel that way. And so they say, you know, if they see a ball player who's very skilled, they put all of their hope into that person. They say, you know, I can't make it out. I'm a gang member. I'll probably die young or go to prison. But I don't want you to follow that path because you have a set of skills that will give you access to mainstream culture. So they really set them apart. They become sacred. They become the symbols of hope. And in some cases, they're thought of as saviors of the community, that potentially if they get out, you know, they can bring others with them.
When you talk about the larger culture encouraging black men to play basketball, can you describe that larger culture?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the myths that was forged in slavery, racial myths really, is that black men and women are sound in body but not in intellect. In other words, that they're not really human beings, that they were sort of animals in human form. Or sort of primitive or underdeveloped human beings. So they could be very strong physically, but didn't have the intellectual capacity that, you know, white Americans have. And that myth has shaped American society and our institutions. And also attitudes towards people of African descent, particularly black men. And so I think one of the reasons why the larger culture assigns the role of athlete to black men is because the culture assumes that they are naturally gifted physically, right? And so, yes, you know, they can play sports better than anybody, but not necessarily do well in school. So I think that stereotype certainly influences people's perceptions and attitudes towards African-American men as naturally gifted athletes, but it also informs African-American males' perspectives on themselves. Right? They internalize that in many cases. So I would never argue that sports doesn't do harm, right, to people of African descent or African American males, right? But I also argue at the same time it is a space of resistance, a space of freedom, right? So, you know, there are really these two things happening simultaneously.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Onaje Woodbine, the author of Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip Hop, and Street Basketball. This is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Onaje Woodbine, Your experience on the basketball court, your skill, your relationship with your father, your personal intellect, took you to Yale University, where you began as a basketball player. Can you share with us that experience and how it ended, where you went after the end of your experience on the court at Yale?
Yeah, so when I arrived at Yale, as you say, you know, my mindset was that I was a basketball player. But at the same time, I valued my inner life in part because of both my mother's pushing of education in the house and my father and I's relationship and his pointing to my inner life as being very important. When I got to Yale and I began to play on the basketball team, I immediately was one of the best players. Even as a freshman, I started and was one of the leading scorers on the team. But there was a huge cultural divide. On the one hand, we were supposed to be a united team, but we had many players, you know, who were white, who were in a fraternity, and the black players weren't a part of it. And then on the basketball court, I think often they mistook my passion for showboating, many of the white players. And so there was a distance there. There was a racial tension there. There were also things that I noticed around mistreatment of women and misogyny, especially a culture, really, in the locker room of misogyny. That disturbed me. And all of those things really shocked me because coming from the inner city, and going to Yale, I thought that at one of the best schools in the world, that, you know, people would be sort of more enlightened around these issues. But that just wasn't the case.
Your experience on the street basketball courts of Massachusetts, of Boston, sounds to me like it's very different than your experience on the Yale basketball court.
Very different, very, very different, you know, and that surprised me. Maybe I was naive, I probably was naive, but it did surprise me. You know, in Roxbury, you put everything on the court, you know. I mean, you know, you played ball in Roxbury, it was like life or death. You know, if you didn't play well, then you might have to join a gang. You know, you'd be subject to the streets. And, you know, we put so much into it. And there was so much love and passion expressed out there. You know, again, it was a way of life. And yet, when I brought that to Yale, I brought that same passion. I would dance on the court. I would scream on the court. I would talk trash on the court. You know, and my teammates reacted for me, which was very strangely, you know, either they were silent, many of them, or, you know, they were secretly holding some sort of animosity towards me, you know, or judging me. And so the other thing, you know, I noticed practices were very mechanical. You know, it was, you know, there was just no fun. There was no feeling. It was like everything was sort of X's and O's, you know, and was done on a very superficial level. And so that was one of the huge disappointments, I think, about, you know, transitioning from the culture of Roxbury to the culture of, you know, predominantly white and elite, you know, university. And you know, by the end of my sophomore year, I was the leading scorer on the team, and I had been voted second team All Ivy League. But I realized that I wasn't getting a good education by remaining on the basketball team, And I wasn't fulfilling my true purpose. And so I decided to leave the team at the end of my sophomore year and to remain in school just as a student. And I wrote a letter to the Yale Daily News about why that I was leaving the team. And you know, my coaches were pretty upset. One coach in particular, an assistant coach, wrote me a letter that was very racist and basically stated that I had only gotten into Yale because I was an athlete and that I would hurt the chances of black people being admitted into Yale by leaving the team. And it was a really trying time, but I knew in my heart and in my bones that in order to fulfill and become the best person I could be, that I needed to leave the basketball team. And so I did.
And the reaction was?
The reaction was, on the one hand, students, when they read my letter to the Daily News, were very supportive. And my professors were very supportive. But on the other hand, my coaches were very upset. And as I say, didn't really get to know me as a human being, you know. I think, you know, and I don't blame them. They're part of a larger system that treats winning as everything. And their salaries are really dependent upon that. And so what ends up happening is coaches began to look at players like employees rather than young people that they're meant to shape and form and educate. And so I think that that's how my coaches reacted. It wasn't sort of trying to help me with a difficult decision. It was rather, you know, I'm upset for basketball reasons, right? That you're leaving the team. And again, you know, I had a racist response from one coach. So I because of their reaction, I knew I had made the right decision, that I in fact was being objectified. I was being treated as a commodity. And I listened to that voice, and I was glad I did.
The voice that your father encouraged you to listen to.
Yeah, you know, my father, that still small voice. And, you know, one of my favorite scholars, Howard Thurman, who was Martin Luther King's mentor during the Civil Rights Movement, he always said that no one can determine the quality of your inner life. You know, that is your locus, your space of resistance. You know, so despite the existence of racism and all of these exploitative systems that we walk and live in every day, that there's something within you that no one can take away. And that has carried me through. And it's been liberating to be aware of that in the midst of, you know, all of the gender and racial and economic forces that try to determine, you know, an individual's life.
At the Phillips Academy, where you teach in Andover, Massachusetts,
yes.
Your book has been adapted into a play.
Yes.
And you asked the question, what does it mean to be a black face in a white place?
Yes.
How do you answer that?
You know, that's a powerful question. For me, what it means is finding opportunities to get beneath the surface. And theater provides that, you know. Theater, like basketball, is another ritual space where people can try on roles and express their emotion in a way that shows something human, right, that we all share in common. So for me, being at Phillips Academy is about creating and finding those opportunities and spaces where we can let go of the mask that we wear and discover what we all share in common.
Does it work? Are you able to do that?
Yeah, I think there are those moments of transcendence in the classroom and in the theater. You know, what was powerful about this project for me and the play itself was that if you go deep enough within, this is what I discovered, that if you go deep enough within yourself, you find this still small voice that we're calling, or this other, some people might call it spirit, that you can actually come out on the other side and see it in somebody else. In other words, the distinctions between us that we carry with us on our everyday life are in some ways illusions. The other in me is the other in you, and we share that in common.
This has been the first of two visits with Onaje Woodbine, author of Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip Hop, and Street Basketball. Listen for us next week for part two. The book Onaje Woodbine recommends is Jesus and the Disinherited by Howard Thurman. This interview was recorded on August 13, 2016. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.